Thank you, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. I'm Frank Hornstein, the chair. We have a quorum, so I'd like to get going. We have 10 bills to do. So I am hoping a couple of them I think will take a little longer than others, but it's still my hope that we, for your planning purposes, can adjourn in the 7 to 7:30 time frame. But if members want to move quickly, it's up to you. So I just want to get all of the testimony in and have ample time to debate the bills. But again, that does depend on how things go. Yes, Representative Champion.
All I'm saying is if you want me to continue to be married, I think we better
finish. Okay, well, we'll try to adjourn by 6:30 then.
There we go.
But we are sensitive to people's schedules and we have other committees meeting. So with that, I'd like to call on Representative Hortman to present our first bill, House File 3263.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3263 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this deals with the speed limit in work zones. And with me from MnDOT is somebody to explain the bill.
Mr. Welcome Chair. To the committee.
Thank you. My name is Cassandra Isaacson. Your agenda says Sue Groth. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer, and basically we are trying to correct what makes it mathematically impossible to set a work zone speed limit on 900 miles of two-lane, two-way roadway that we raised to 60 miles per hour. And so this is just to correct that so that work zone speed limits can be placed on those roadways, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and thank you for your to-the-point but helpful testimony. And Representative Hortman, I see that you have an A1 amendment, I believe.
That's right. Mr. Chair,
you want to move that?
I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion? I think this is just language to get the bill in the form the author wants to consider it in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Are there any questions of the author or representative from MnDOT?
I just wanted to quickly say a work zone speed limit is 40 miles an hour, and so this is just allowing us to set that on roads that are right now posted at 60.
Any further discussion?
Fine bill.
Okay. Always good to have Representative Erdahl weigh in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Members, we could probably get out of here by 5 if this continues. Representative Beard is up next with House File 3173. And I believe, Representative Beard, you are going to be moving this to Representative Pawlowski's committee. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I hadn't even given it a thought, but if you'd like me to, I'd be happy.
Apparently that's where it needs to go.
Okay.
There's rulemaking in your bill, I believe.
For a local government
connection.
It's either going to go there or he'll probably send it to Representative Nelson's committee.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
So. Okay. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not a member of this committee, although I wish
that's right. I keep forgetting that because we're meeting here. I will move then that House File 3173 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3173 is a simple little bill. It was brought to me by our friends at the Short Line Railroad Association. Members, as we're looking at the state rail plan and looking at some of the heroic work that the regionals, Class 2 and Class 3 railroads have done around the state in preserving freight rail transportation in particular in corridors that might have use in other ways as we move into the future, we want to be sure that we're not putting an onerous load on them that they can't bear, particularly financially. And Mr. Chairman, I should point out, although I'd love to take credit for the cookies coming around the table, which would help my bill pass, I'm sure I did not actually bake the cookies. So enjoy them while we talk.
But are you providing them?
Maybe.
No, actually, members, okay, because that's now on the table for discussion, Anne, our wonderful page, is providing those, and please partake if you would like.
So in other words, no, I did not provide the cookies, but thank you, Anne. Members, what we have is as cities are moving ahead with complying with stormwater systems and paying for those, they're more and more cities are creating stormwater utility fees and levying them on all their pieces of property in town. Of course, we have many small towns in Minnesota with regional railroads running through them, and I think that those parcels of land are being eyed jealously by the cities and counties, who I'm sure are going to have something to say here shortly, Mr. Chairman. So what we're trying to do is exempting railroad right-of-way, switching yards, bridges, and trestles from that. Mr. Chairman, I do have Mr. Mark Wagner from the Twin City Western Railroad who can speak to this a little more pointedly than I can, if I may introduce my witness and let him testify.
Sure. And Representative Beard, I see that you have an amendment as well. Did you want to move that now or later?
Can we let Mr. Wagner talk? Then I'll talk about that amendment because others may like to speak to it.
Of course. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Mark Wagner, President of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. We operate from St. Paul, Minnesota, out to Milbank, South Dakota. And committee members, this issue came up in the late 90s where we had our first city do a stormwater utility. And discussing it with that city, they agreed to treat the railroad like they do one of their city's streets. So in essence, while they have a stormwater utility, they in effect exempted the railroad. Subsequent to that, another city a few years later created a stormwater utility and did not classify the railroad as a street, but rather like a park. And so we started getting these bills in the mail, which are very unaccountable to us unless we tie it back to our property taxes, to pay these bills. And in our case, it's not a lot of money. I mean, we're talking maybe $2,000 a year. But since then, we've had another city do a utility. Now we're up to $4,000 a year. And we would love to charge our customers a surcharge for that to pay for it, but we can't. They're going to go back to trucks. And I guess I see this as kind of there's a federal law governing railroads that, in essence, says states can't levy taxes against a railroad that are also not levied against trucks or waterways that are, in essence, keep the modes on a level playing field. And this one here clearly hits the railroads. When we do our property taxes for the state of Minnesota, the Department of Revenue has us compile all kinds of figures for them. They assign a value to the railroad, and they distinguish between what's called railroad operating property, which is the property we need to run the railroad, versus non-operating property, which might be facilities we might lease, etc. So I'm only thinking about the operating property for this exemption. But railroads were engineered in the late 1800s to have their own drainage systems. We have culverts, we've got ditches, we've got all kinds of things. And in the ensuing years, with the ensuing development of cities around us, what we find are apartment buildings with parking lots that drain onto our track. We have all kinds of streets, things that drain onto railroad property. Now, in turn, we're asked to pay for that drainage in addition to our own. And we just think that it's fundamentally not fair. And so what we're asking for is for the cities to treat the railroad as a public transportation vehicle the same way they would a city street. And in talking with Representative Beard, the way he's got this worded seems to accomplish that.
And thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Beard, did you want to either move your amendment or amplify any points that are made?
Mr. Chairman, this would be a good time to move the A1 amendment, and if it moves, and I will speak to it.
Okay, let's do that. It's to get the bill in the shape that the author would like to have us consider, and all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'll move that, sorry. Yeah. All of those in favor signify by saying aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. You're an honorary member of this committee.
Thank you. I'm flattered.
It's transportation, after all.
Yes.
Okay, so, Representative Beard, why don't you explain the amendment?
Mr. Chairman and members, as I mentioned previously, you know, I've got a soft spot in my heart for the Class 1 or Class 2 threes and short lines that are working so hard to keep rail service in Minnesota. And so I was looking to defend them against being doubly taxed or having to pay twice to move stormwater. They pay it themselves, now they got to pay the cities and counties as well. When my friends from the Class 1s came along and said, well, do you mind if we hook our caboose to your train and we get the same exemption? I said, well, yeah, I suppose. It's all the same principle, that this is operating right-of-way, that has been built in many cases for well over a century, sometimes 140 years. They've already been handling their own stormwater, so why should they be paying for it again? And so with that, I had the A1 amendment drafted, and it alters, it basically what it does is only changes my bill by eliminating community-based railroads, class ones, or class twos and threes, and adds all railroad property in Minnesota that's operating property. I should point out again, this is not warehouses, this is not parking lots, this is not office buildings. This is just the track and track structure necessary for rail freight. To speak to the amendment, I've invited Mr. Brian Sweeney from Burlington Northern Santa Fe to come if you'd like to hear from him, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Mark, could you go to Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney, Legislative Counsel for BNSF Railway in St. Paul. I'd like to echo Mr. Wagner's comments that we have a situation where the infrastructure for the railroads was put together quite some time ago, complete with drainage systems, ditches, culverts. We maintain those. Over the years, we have begun receiving more and more stormwater runoff from adjacent properties onto our property. And in addition, you know, this is property on our part that is not paved over very often, which minimizes the runoff. We're receiving runoff from other properties. And then we have situations where there has been no problem at all with drainage for low these many decades. And then a strip mall or something is put up. Acres are covered with asphalt. Water is running off in our direction or is generating a problem that has to be dealt with. And then we get pulled into the assessing district. In situations where we're actually delivering stormwater to a system, a municipal system, yeah, we don't have a problem with that. It's these types of situations where a special assessment district is set up for a new project that was not caused by us, and in fact we have been, over the years, have had to do things like expand our culverts, increase our maintenance costs, and so on to take care of the water that has been flowing our direction already. There are locations where we receive water from neighborhoods onto our property. We have to deal with it ourselves. We're not billing for that. We're looking for that type of an exemption to not be swept up into these other projects. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from members for either Representative Beard or the Class 1 and 2 and 3 railroad representatives we have here? Mm-hmm. Seeing none, I'd like to call on Craig Johnson to testify. I'm sure the League of Cities has some concerns about this bill and would welcome your testimony, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And unfortunately, yes, we do have concerns about House File 3173. For those of you who have sat through many Environment Committee hearings, you probably can guess what those are. For those of you who haven't had that special joy, we have a steady cascade of requirements coming from the federal government, from the state government, and from local watershed management organizations and watershed districts that are mandating what controls cities have to have on stormwater. We have permits in place that have to be updated annually and show that every year we are increasing those controls on stormwater, and the costs of those things are very, very large. An example is White Bear Lake is currently being ordered to clean up two stormwater ponds that are going to cost $500,000 each because the contamination of the sediment in the bottom of them makes it a hazardous material. Eden Prairie was just informed they have 900 ponds that they have to have a plan for cleaning up immediately. They have to have it by March 15th under a PCA enforcement order. These are the kinds of things our cities are dealing with stormwater right now. And everyone in the community gets assessed on a rate scale based on how much impervious surface they have. If any one class of properties gets exempted from that, the cost of the system gets split up among the rest. So if rail yards were exempted, however much money was being generated from there would be split among the residences and the businesses and the rest of the community to pay the cost of the system. And that's just how it would work. We actually don't think that's either necessary or fair. Rail yards actually have significant amounts of impervious surface. There may be water that runs onto their property from other property. That's what happens with water. But it also runs off of their property. And that's what our city stormwater systems have to deal with. And if they are within city limits, their water is part of the city's stormwater system that the city is responsible for managing. So, members, I would respectfully ask that you not support this piece of legislation. I would add that stormwater utilities are not a tax. They are a user fee for you being connected to municipal stormwater systems, and they're paid by everyone. Whether you have a driveway that's your impervious surface, a parking lot in front of your business, or a rail yard.
Okay. Well, we have a classic railroads versus cities fight here. So, members, do you have any questions of Mr. Johnson? Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, whoever would like to answer, typically I'm thinking of railroads just with the actual, the metal part. And I know that there are stations, et cetera, but is that part of the station, or are we talking absolutely everything?
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, as I understand the question, the way the bill is drafted, it's not just the tracks that we're talking about, which I would argue are actually pervious surfaces, but it includes the rail yards, bridges, trestles, and associated right-of-way with that. What it does not include are the office buildings, parking lots, warehouses, terminals, and so on, where there would be truck traffic. I'm thinking of piggyback yards and so on and so forth. It's just, no, it's the right-of-way itself and the ditching and so on that they've already bought and paid for. That's the issue I'm trying to address here.
I share some of Mr. Johnson's concerns. I guess I would ask Mr. Johnson, when you, with these assessments and levies, et cetera, do you have any kind of ballpark figure as to, you know, if you took a, I can't even say average size city, but what type of maybe percentage hit would a typical city take with a couple of tracks going through it? I mean, how much money are we talking about in terms of the impact to a city budget? Do you have any range that you could let us know about?
Mr. Chair, members, I couldn't hazard a guess as to range. It's going to vary tremendously based on what percentage of the total area of the community is covered by rail line, but obviously that's a lesser amount than some areas. The real factor is what happens to water that lands on that area. That's how most cities set their rate, and the less water soaks in where the water falls, the higher the rate usually is for that property use, because it means more water is running off and having to be dealt with by the city system. And to be clear, members, this isn't just about culverts and ditches anymore. That's what stormwater started out as, is flood control. We tried to get the waters out of the basements, off the streets, and to the nearest ditch as fast as we could. Now we actually have to do it as a pollution control, and we have to slow this water down and treat it and get the sediment out and the chemicals out and the temperature to be the right temperature so that it doesn't affect the wildlife in the stream it's running into. And it's a pretty complex system to put together.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there any other questions of any of the witnesses, the author? I'll give Representative Beard the last word.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, just a couple of concluding remarks. Yes, this, knowing how important, especially to greater Minnesota, the difference a railroad makes in holding truck rates in line, taking some of the heavier traffic off of our roads and highways, particularly the county highways, and how much even amongst just the rail competition itself, having a competing carrier to work in behalf of the shippers keeps more money in the rural economy. A penny a bushel means a lot to a small town in greater Minnesota. This is just one of those things we need to watch out for. Again, I'll stress that the bill as it's written is for the operating structure itself, which is largely pervious surfaces, and Mr. Johnson is correct, although I insist that the ditches and the stormwater management has been bought and paid for over the last century by the railroads. Perhaps the other issue that we're dealing with actual treatment of stormwater is something that's relatively new in the last couple of decades and is another issue, and perhaps we might want to think through the ramifications it has for long stretches of private property like railroads, and whether we want to continue to exempt the tracks themselves and treat them like city streets, or whether we actually want to have the cities levying this cost against these small businesses. Just to recap, that's the essence of the bill. As it's amended, it would exempt all railroad operating property in the state, not just the Class 2s and 3s. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll stand for questions, or I'll wait for the committee's direction.
There are no further questions or discussion. Renew the motion that House File 3173 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No. I believe the motion does prevail.
We'll see you in Mr. Pulaski's committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Nornes, I thought I saw you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Nornes. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will move that House File 2851 be recommended to pass and sent on to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is very short and easy to explain, but it brought help along anyway. So this is an agreement between the City of Fergus Falls and MnDOT to allow this very, very short stretch of state highway to become part of the City of Fergus Falls. And go ahead and introduce yourself.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And this turnback serves an old state treatment center in Fergus Falls, which is no longer operated by the state. The city has acquired ownership of the treatment center and is exploring development opportunities there. And so the city is willing looking forward to the turn back of this section of former trunk highway. It's a short segment. It's only about a half mile in length. And our turn back agreement includes providing about $275,000 in turn back funds to the city in 2012. And I believe you have a copy of a map showing the turn back and the resolution by the city council.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's no, do you want to amplify any more about the Fergus Falls part of this? Because I know we have a
there's an amendment.
Kuchiching amendment here. So
I think it's pretty straightforward, and like was mentioned, the city now owns the property, including the actual former state hospital and all of the buildings associated with it. So it's a good agreement, and I have nothing further to add.
Good. Well, we have an A1 amendment, which I'll move, members, and this is coming to us from Representative Van Zels. Believe me, I know he's worked very hard on this one with Kuchiching County and the City of International Falls. And I think this is in order here. It's a similar turn back provision, the A1 amendment. I don't see, is Representative Van Zels here? Oh, there he is, hiding behind there. Representative Van Zels, do you want to talk to your amendment? I will move that amendment, but I want you to give us a little briefing on it before we vote.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and thank to you, Representative Nornes. This amendment is the culmination of a long, complicated process involving MnDOT District 1, the City of International Falls, and the County of Kuchiching to reach agreement on a turnback proposal. There are resolutions on file with MnDOT District 1. There's peace, and I ask for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you, members. So, any questions of Representative Van Zels? Yes, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see any reference to who it's turned back to.
I believe, Mr. Chairman and Representative Leader, the local road authority is Kuchiching County, so it's turned back to the county.
I don't have a problem with it, Representative Anzo, but it doesn't say that. It just said beginning and appointed Kuchiching County state aid. It doesn't say who it's turned back to. And what you're saying, it's turned back to the county. I see that, but it doesn't say that in the bill. Maybe I don't read it.
Representative Leader, why don't we ask Mr. Burris to comment on that, if if it's not clear, we could probably fix that with an oral amendment. So, Mr. Burris? Okay, he's thinking about it.
Mr. Chair, in the meantime, if we might hear from MnDOT if they support this.
Sure, that's a good point. Mr. Dean?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, the department supports this, and unfortunately the timing just didn't work out to have this be a departmental bill, but it is identified as part of our turn back program. And to get, if I could, to Representative Leader's question, typically the legislation for turnbacks just repeals the portion or the establishment of the trunk highway in statute. So I don't know that it's necessary for us to identify in the legislation who it's being turned back to.
Representative
Leader.
I beg to differ. I recognize that, but was it a county road, a city street, or a county state highway? It doesn't say it. Or it doesn't say even to the city of International Falls. And I'm not disagreeing with happening, but I think the bill is not clear if you looked at it.
Just to be clear, Representative Leader, I think we're actually talking about the Coochaching County portion of this, or both of them.
It's a constitutional, that's a trunk highway.
Yeah, I think we're looking at the A1 amendment, and maybe Mr. Rudin, if you want to comment on that. And also, just while you're up there, to clarify, does MnDOT support both the turnback in Fergus Falls and the International Falls Coochaching County?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we support both turnbacks.
Okay.
And the one in International Falls is currently a trunk highway, and we will be turning it over to the county.
Okay.
But the city supports the turn back as well.
Okay. Mr. Burris will comment on your question, Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair and members, I think I would need some more time to work with MnDOT on it. The language in the amendment doesn't match kind of the standard language that's put forth for turnbacks, but there are some provisions in statute that lay out how turnbacks work, and some of those might actually provide the agency with the discretion that it needs to handle the turnback and the handover administratively. But I'm just not sure I'd need some more time to work through that.
Well, I mean, Representative Nornes and Representative Anzels, I mean, I think this is easy enough to work through. We know exactly what the intent is. I'm comfortable moving this, if you are Representative Leader, with the understanding that this will be clarified to conform with whatever precedent we have in statute for that. Okay. Are there any further questions of either Representative Nornes or Representative Anzels? Let's vote on the Anzels amendment. I don't think we've done that yet. This is the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So we now have our House file before us, 2851, as amended. Is there any further discussion? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2851, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, both Representative Nornes and Representative Anzels. We have Representative Anzels again. Okay.
Starting to feel comfortable here, Mr. Chairman.
Hi, good to see you again. And I'll move that House File 3008. You know, there's a couple committees that want to see this, so you're a popular guy.
Sure.
I think we need to send it first to Representative Pawlowski, and then I believe Representative Greiling wanted to see it after that. But in order to make deadline, let's send it to Representative Pawlowski first. So the motion would be to move House File 3008 to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. And I will move that. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm joined here by Tom Kelleher from the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. And I believe you have in your packets one amendment, the A10 amendment. I would like to put that on the bill.
That's for 2278.
810-2278.
Oh, I got it. Yep. I will move that amendment, Representative Van Zels. Is this, you want to explain the amendment as well?
I'll turn it over to Mr. Keller to explain the amendment.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. Just very quickly, the amendment is mostly technical above lines 1.8. It does two things. It talks about the pre-employment drug screening only instead of current law, which is pre-employment drug and alcohol screening. The School Bus Operators Association would like to just have the one pre-employment criteria. I should pause for a minute, too, and just say that the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transit, the Minnesota School Boards Association, and the Minnesota School Bus Association with the Department of Public Safety and the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services have all looked at this, and we've all sort of agreed that this is the language that's preferred by everybody who's involved in school bus industries, both from the regulation side and from industry. So just to continue on, at the end of line 1.4 on the amendment, it adds random or reasonable suspicion to use a breathalyzer in situations where you believe that the employee has been drinking on the job. And then lines 1.6 to 1.7 exempts school bus operators from two statutes in regards to a confirmatory retest if the employee fails the original breathalyzer. And subdivision 10, which is referenced at the end of that line, talks about limitations on employee discharges and discipline and discrimination is what the current law is, what those citations are. And it was suggested by attorneys and by the department that we have that exemption, basically in regards to some of the situations that are in current news, that when there's situations where a school bus driver is impaired or there's under suspicion of impairment, we want them not driving buses with children on them. And then the last part, the rulemaking exemption, is for the department, the Division of Motor Vehicle Services. It's a rulemaking exemption is the rationale for why we're going to Representative Plowski's committee, and that just makes it easier and less expensive for the commissioner to write the rule in regards to physical qualifications for a Type 3 bus driver.
Okay. Thank you. I think there's already some questions. You can take those now. Representative Holberg, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to the amendment and how it's worded. So I understand that your intent is to leave the pre-employment drug test, because of course most drug tests can't be done with a breathalyzer. And so with your amendment, does it make it impossible for an employer to require a drug test? Because you give them permission to use a breathalyzer to fulfill alcohol testing requirements, but what happens to the issue around drug testing and whether or not that can occur at any time using whatever test is appropriate for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the current law talks about a pre-employment drug screening. I'm looking at page 2, line 2.24. Clause, paragraph F, I think they're calling it. And it said the law that we're amending in the amendment concerning the new law in the bill, House File 3008, current law talked about a pre-employment drug and alcohol screening. What we're trying to do is get out from under that alcohol testing for pre-employment. Post-employment, I'd have to ask someone else to answer that question, Representative Holberg, because I don't think there's a requirement nor a obstacle to us drug testing a post-employment situation. I think
And I'm just wondering with your, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kelleher, I'm just wondering with your language here, it's kind of silent on the whole drug issue once you're employed. I mean, you're addressing the alcohol issue, but I want to make sure that an employer with reasonable suspicion of drug use has the opportunity to conduct a test for something besides just alcohol.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, as I stated, we are talking about only changing the pre-employment drug testing in regards, well, the pre-employment drug testing we're keeping, and the pre-employment alcohol testing we're deleting, but giving everybody in the industry the option to use a breathalyzer under random or reasonable suspicion situations. So we're only talking about, the only thing we're changing here is the breathalyzer for reasonable and random suspicion regardless, it's post-employment, I'm sorry.
I don't know if somebody here is here from the State Patrol School Bus Safety Division. Maybe they can tell me about whether or not.
I see a number of uniforms out there. Officer, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Lieutenant Edward Carroll, Minnesota State Patrol.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, can you tell me if you've had a chance to review the amendment being considered and whether or not you have any concerns about an employer's ability to request drug testing of a school bus driver?
Mr. Chair.
Officer Carroll.
Representative. No, we've looked over this bill. We have no problem with it. There's some minor changes in there. And one of the things they wanted to do was with the breathalyzer. Is a lot of times it's a lot cheaper to use a breathalyzer to do a alcohol test. They can still do the drug test, the blood drug test through this. That is still, you can't obviously do a drug test with a breathalyzer. But the reason why is a little bit of a savings of money in this.
And
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, if I might, what standard do they have to meet in order to conduct a drug test on a current employee?
Mr. Chair,
Officer Carroll.
Representative. Would be under the reasonable suspicion. They take training in reasonable suspicion. All supervisors in the school bus industry have to take reasonable suspicion. As you saw in the news, what happened up in Anoka, that was a reasonable suspicion test. One of the other bus drivers recognized the signs. We stopped the bus, got the driver out, let the bus continue on its route, and arrested the school bus driver.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful, Officer. Okay, we're still on the amendment. Is there any further discussion to the A-10 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So we now have a House File 3008 before us. Any additional comments, Representative Van Zels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just want to remind the committee that this pertains to Type 3 vehicles, which is a an automobile or a minivan or an SUV or a station wagon. And it, in all cases, it must be capable of carrying 10 or fewer students. And that's what this bill is about.
Mr. Kelleher, did you have some?
Just one quick comment, Mr. Chair. I think the fastest way to describe the bill is that we're trying to just conform the Type 3 bus situation, vehicle situation, to what is mostly under current law for school buses, the yellow ones. And some of this is technical and sort of conforms those two bodies of law together. I understand that this committee and the Senate counterpart did a lot of Type 3 bus issues last year, and this is sort of the piecemeal fixing up of some technical issues.
Okay. Any further discussion? Do you have any final comments, Representative Van Zels?
Thank you.
Okay, I believe we're ready to vote then. So, members, I will renew my motion that House File 3008, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent on to the State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. You're two for two today, Representative Van Zels. Okay. We'll now move on to Representative Morrow's bill, House File 3117. And I believe we're have an author's several amendments here, a couple of amendments that are being passed out now. So, Representative Morrow,
thank you, Mr.
To your bill.
Chair, I would move House File 3117.
And I think we're going to Commerce.
Going to Commerce. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that it be passed and moved to the Commerce Committee. And, Mr. Chair, there are two amendments, the A3 and the A4 amendments that are being distributed right now. And I'll, as you all are getting a copy of those bill, those amendments, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill deals with what's called anti-indemnification or indemnity provisions in motor transportation contracts. I've got concerns about the public policy of having shippers be able to, in essence, avoid their liability and shift them onto the trucking company. But to describe this situation in more detail, I have two representatives from the Minnesota Trucking Association to explain a little bit more about why this bill is needed. I'll allow them to introduce themselves, and then I will move to two amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chairman John Hauslodden, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. And
I'm Keith Klein. I'm Chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association, also Executive Vice President of Transport America, a trucking company in Eagan, Minnesota.
I'd like to welcome both of you to the committee.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'll just invite maybe Mr. Klein, Mr. Hauslodden, just to talk a little bit about what the bill is about as members have a chance to look at the two amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hauslodden, welcome.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Hauslodden, as I said, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We are a statewide association representing 650 motor carriers and their allied vendors. And I'm here to testify today in support of House File 3117. We want to stress this is a bill which addresses fairness, accountability, and safety. The MTA has brought forth this legislation in response to requests from our members, most of whom operate fleets of 50 trucks or less. I'd like to note at the beginning that we are really not charting new territory here, but learning from the lessons of others, both other states and previous legislatures in this state. 17 other states have adopted this or very similar language. Iowa just sent it to the governor's desk within the last 2 weeks. And what's more, the Minnesota legislature has already established a precedent for making certain indemnification clauses void and unenforceable. And that's in Minnesota Statutes 337.02, which does that for the building and construction contracts. And I understand that that's one of the amendments that we'll be referencing here today. I have with me today Mr. Keith Klein, one of our members of our board of directors. And if it pleases the chair, Mr. Klein will give you a little more detail, and then I will wrap up with just one example of how it plays out in real life.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Klein. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Keith Klein, Chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association and also Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of Transport America, a trucking company in Eagan, Minnesota. As you know, motor carriers have to comply with state and federal regulations as they transport goods. We also have contracts with shippers that spell out additional legal duties and responsibilities. Many of the provisions are important and beneficial. However, our members, most of whom operate fleets of 50 trucks or smaller, are reporting a growing pattern among large shippers adding one-way indemnification clauses to freight hauling agreements. These indemnification clauses require trucking companies to hold shippers harmless for the shipper's own negligence and intentional acts and omissions. The MTA has brought forth this legislation in response to requests from our members. Trucking firms feel that if they balk at these provisions, they will lose the business, especially given the pricing competitiveness in today's freight market. Not only are these provisions unfair, they reduce the incentive for shippers to operate in a safe manner. These indemnification clauses effectively eliminate the incentive for shippers to perform their duties and responsibilities safely. This creates a considerable risk to the public safety, and it shifts liability from one party to the other. And one of the basic reasons for assigning liability is to persuade people to regulate their own behavior. For example, if a shipper fails to appropriately secure a load inside a trailer when loading and then seals the trailer, there's nothing that a trucking company can do to change its own behavior to make things safer. As an example, and I'll go to our company, we didn't have this provision in place at that time in terms of the contract, but we had a situation where a shipper loaded our trailer with totes of paint and sealed the trailers. Our driver picked it up, went down the road, the tote of paint tipped over because it was improperly loaded and leaked out the back and painted a bunch of cars that were traveling behind our vehicle. Unfortunate situation, but if this indemnification language would have been in place, even though there was negligence on the fact of the shipper, we would have been held accountable for having to pay for the repairs to the vehicles associated with that, and the shipper would have no incentive to change their behavior in terms of safe loading practices. I'd like to be clear about what this legislation actually does. It would make void any provision in a motor carrier contract that sought to indemnify a promisee or a shipper for its own negligence, intentional acts, or omissions leading to legal claims. It would also preserve the incentive for shippers involved in motor carrier contracts to perform their obligations and duties safely. On the other hand, this bill would not establish any new legal duties and responsibilities for either party. It would not make void entire contracts. Rather, it would make void only the offending provisions I've described. And finally, it would not otherwise interfere with the freedom of contract, except to improve safety and assign responsibility where it rightfully belongs. You should have in front of you an example of an actual shipper contract clause employing the one-way indemnification language. I'd like to, if it's okay with the chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Houseladen to share one example of how this played out.
Okay. Thank you. Proceed, Mr. Houseladen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an example, I received an email from a member that talked about an incident that was in the northern part of the state. They were at a facility with their truck ready to load some product, and in a different area of the facility, there was some welding going on by the property owner, by the property owner's employee. There was an explosion and a major fire ensued. The truck, which just happened to be there, was engulfed and the entire truck was lost, but because there was such a clause in place, that trucking company could not go to the shipper for any damages and had to eat a $50,000 cost. They were self-insured, so the first $50,000 of that loss they eat due to no negligence of their own. So that's just one example, and thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Houseladen. Are there any questions of the author, the representatives from the Trucking Association? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I should move now the two amendments. First, Mr. Chair, if I might move the A3 amendment, and Mr. Houseladen will briefly explain the need for the amendment. And members, I do apologize. We are not moving lines 1.31 and 1.32, and I apologize. That's my handwritten note at the bottom. I understand that language at 1.31 and 1.32 is obsolete language. Okay. And with that in mind, I will turn to Mr. Houseladen to explain briefly why this amendment is necessary.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, very simply.
We've had some discussion with one party that said they wanted to make sure that this bill does not in any way prohibit the ability of a shipper and carrier to have in their contract a statement that says that the shipper can be listed as an additional insured. So it doesn't prohibit it. They wanted it blatant. We said yes. The language that you see here is lifted from the other section of statute, which we referred to, which deals with the construction industry. So we're just bringing that over.
Outside of, I think, Representative Moore and Representative Champion, we're an attorney-free committee here. So Representative, or Mr. Burris, could you maybe interpret some of this language for us in this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, actually, I've got a technical suggestion on some associated cleanup with that change that eliminates 1.31 and 1.32. That would be to remove some additional language because the structure of that paragraph is to list out two options and one of them is being eliminated. So I would suggest modifying the amendment to in a couple of ways here. Page 1, line 27 of the amendment, delete either. Page 1, delete line 28. Mm-hmm. Page 1, line 29, delete numeric 1. And page 1, line 30, delete the semicolon and insert a period. So that would make it all one sentence.
And Mr. Chair, I believe that Mr. Burris is correct, and I would move that amendment to the amendment.
Okay, I believe we have that. I'm just going to make sure Mr. Burris can maybe repeat that one more time for the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment to the amendment would be page 1, line 27, delete either. Page 1, delete line 28. Page 1, line 29, delete numeric 1. Page 1, line 30, delete the semicolon and insert a period.
Okay. Is everyone clear on that? Does anyone have questions? This is a rather technical amendment, so just want to make sure people know what we're doing here. Okay, well, do you have any further? Okay, members, I think we should vote first on the amendment to the amendment. And so all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. And now the A3 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So we have the A3 amendment, and
And then, Mr. Chair, you also have members an A4 amendment. This reflects some very recent negotiation and compromise among several groups, including the Ocean Carrier Equipment Management Association and others. This is, again, the H3117A4 amendment.
Just one second. Okay, thank you. I have that.
The language on lines 1.5 to 1.7 were requested by the Ocean Carrier Equipment Management Association. They're involved with intermodal equipment, mostly with ocean carriers, and we reviewed the language. We agreed, so we inserted the language to give comfort to that association. And then Mr. Halson could talk briefly, if you'd like, Mr. Chair, about why we've inserted lines 1.3 and 1.4.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Halson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, again, you know, in drafting, you think you've covered everything, and then you have folks come up to you and talk, and basically they said we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just for hire carriers, but it also included private carriers. So we made that clear.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? All right. I think we can vote on that one. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. So we have House File 3117 as amended. Is there any further discussion of the bill? Representative Morrow, do you have any...
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members, for your time.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Okay. Then I, Representative Morrow renews his motion that House File 3117 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. So thank you very much. And we now have House File 2915, Representative Leader. So Representative Leader, Mr. Chairman. I believe that you're going to the General Register with this one.
That's correct.
So,
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2915 to be passed and passed to the General Register.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Leader. Do you want to go explain the bill or go right to the testimony?
Mr. Chair, this has no fiscal note. There's a fiscal note, but I mean it's zero, so I just wanted to bring that up before we forget.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 2915 deals with the process of prioritizing bridges. In the past, we've had with Chapter 152 for the 10-year bond period, we have specific reference to bonding for bridges, and this will clarify over and above that that the state or MnDOT will prioritize those bridges based on some risk factors and also based on some criteria, and have someone from the bridge department, Nancy, I forgot her last name.
Dobenberger?
Yeah.
Okay.
To testify. If she could.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Dobenberger, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Dobenberger, and I'm with the MnDOT Bridge Office and here to talk about this proposed amendment to Section 155 of the statute governing the Trunk Highway Bridge Improvement Program. The purpose of this bill, as Representative Leader mentioned, is to require a system of bridge prioritization beyond the 2008 legislation that that established the Chapter 152 bridge program. And that program concludes on June 30th of 2018. So this new language would apply to bridges that were not originally in the program and proposes to include risk-based criteria for identifying projects to produce an understandable and transparent system that can be more easily communicated to the public. This legislation, well, prior to it, Chapter 152 bridge program, we had risk inherent in our planning process for bridge repair and replacement. The Central Bridge Office provides guidance to the MnDOT districts on bridges based on the age of the bridge, the type of construction, the condition of the bridge, structurally deficient status, whether or not the bridge is fracture critical. They also take into account load restrictions, traffic volumes, and susceptibility of bridge foundations to being undermined during a flood. And then the MnDOT districts use this guidance from the MnDOT Bridge Office, along with their own experience from maintenance of the bridges, to develop a program. MnDOT is currently in the process of retaining a consultant to develop this risk-based system for bridge project identification that would consider the probability of interruption to service, such as a deterioration of a deck requiring a lane closure, or foundation damage due to flooding, or even a bridge hit by an overheight vehicle. And then also the consequence of a service interruption, which would consider the traffic volume, the length of a detour, and the functional classification of the roadway. So this classical risk-based system will produce a ranked list of MnDOT bridges, and it'll be one step, kind of main step, in the overall planning process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Taubenberger. Are there any questions of MnDOT or the author, even? Make it straightforward. Thank you. Chairman Leader, do you have any final comments you want to make?
No. I'd just like to renew my motion that the House File 2915 be recommended pass and sent on, or put on a general register.
Okay. Thank you. The motion before us is to pass House File 2915 and send it to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. So thank you, Representative Leader. And we are now on to House File 3334, Representative Junkie. I see him. And so I will move Representative Junkie's bill. He's no stranger to transportation, but move that to the general register, right. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you're right. I spent many years on this committee, except for the last few where it's had conflicts with the Ag and Vets Committee and other things where I have to be. So I do miss you guys. So in that light, I brought a bill so I'd come see you. And this is a good bill, and I will tell you up front, and I'll explain at the end, we're still working on some language with MnDOT, and we're happy to do that, but I want to tell my story and tell you why the bill's here. If we move it to the floor, and then what I'll probably do is also develop language for that fine bill that you have coming to the floor, the omnibus bill. I think that's a good place to tuck it into, too, but I'll work with Mr. Burris and others on language as we move forward. Basically, members, what this bill does is provide for an alternative bidding process on all projects where it's applicable from the time of the bill forward. So we're not interrupting any projects that are in the works now or on the drawing board or being bid out. This is for all projects from the day this passes going forward that will be developed. For those of you that don't understand the alternative bid project, and certainly I'm a neophyte to it too, but I do, I'm going to in a minute have a testifier add some expert opinion, but in my elementary understanding, here's what it is. Basically, let's take a road out my way, Highway 23 going west of Wilmer, or Highway 71 going south of Wilmer, a state highway. When that road is up for rebuild or doing new sections of it or whatever, at that point in time, what we do is call for an alternative bid process, which means you get a bid in concrete as well as asphalt pavement. And what they do, it's not apples to apples. We understand that concrete has a longer life. Asphalt would need more maintenance and overlays before that concrete life is done. But you consider that all into the bid. So at the end of the day, you're actually adding all those costs together, the increased overlays and maintenance of one and the lifespan and upfront costs of the other. So at the end of the day, you can actually have a fair cost and a fair comparison. Here's why I'm bringing it this year, and this is really key. I really consider this a jobs bill, Mr. Chair, and that's what we're talking about, and let me tell you why. We think there's very few people that do concrete pavement in the state, all right? So when we're bidding out in concrete pavement, there's a limited number of state folks that will bid that, state contractors. We have a whole slew of contractors, particularly in rural Minnesota, that have the ability to do asphalt pavement and bid that. Consequently, what we're finding is we think some of these bids are coming in higher because you have less people bidding them. And if we do it this way, Mr. Chair, we'd have opportunities to not only save money, but then that money would be rolled back into our MnDOT districts right away in millions of dollars. Plus, a lot of our local companies and local contractors would be able to bid these jobs and hopefully keep those jobs local rather than bringing in South Dakota or Wisconsin pavement firms to do these jobs. So we see it as a jobs bill as well as a money-saving bill, and that's really why I have it here. But, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Harris Dunick, who's no stranger to this committee either. He's been here in the years past when I've been on the committee, and he's the owner of Dunick Brothers Construction out of my area, one of those fine rural construction groups. But I'd like him to weigh in and give his experiences and talk about some of the cost savings if we would have this in place even in the last year, what we might be seeing. So if you'd allow.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Harris Dunick. I'm from Spicer, Minnesota at the present time. I am a family member of a contracting firm for the last 87 years. Back about 30 years ago, I did a lot of work for the Honorable Mr. Leader when he was in Polk County, and we did a lot of work for him at that time. But anyhow, thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. When I spoke, Al spoke with me about this maybe a month ago or a month and a half ago, and I told him a little bit about what I have seen happening. And through the process of bidding over the last several years, things have changed considerably. And things have changed considerably in the area of energy especially. And when we started talking about alternate bids, this is probably several years ago, and we've been working with the Highway Department, with the DOT at this time, in regards to these things, and we have a good relationship with the DOT, and they are starting to work at this thing. But this isn't something that's necessarily new. The process has been going on, but there hasn't been a whole lot of results to the process. But what's happening now, which is quite interesting, first of all, from our standpoint, our company can build both asphalt roads and concrete roads. So it's, you know, we can do whatever. But the thing is that all of you are facing some issues, especially now, in regards to where are you going to get money? Where are you going to get money, whether it's in transportation or any place else? So I think you have to start looking at this alternative bid issue. Now, there are several things that come into play on that in regards to that, and that's life cycle costing. And this is something we're going to talk about today because this gets pretty deep. And the DOT is into that thing pretty deep, so they'll be able to handle that. But one thing you will remember, and you'll remember this after I leave here today, is that you have ribbons. You have ribbons of oil wells in the state of Minnesota all the way through the state where there's asphalt roads. When you start looking at what it costs for a ton of asphalt today, and when you go to take this back up, and most of you are familiar with recycling, Representative Leader, you certainly are, that you can use at least 30% of this product back into the road that has been bid. And based on the cost of asphalt today, and something you have already paid for, can go back into your product and lessen the cost of that product. That has to be looked at. That takes a serious look at. And this is what we're encouraging the people at the DOT level to do. And there's a lot of things that come into play in regards to interest rates and all of these issues. But recycling, both in the concrete and in the asphalt, is not part of the formula. And that must get in there. That must get in there. For the benefit of the taxpayers of this state and the people that are using gasoline and paying gasoline tax. And I would just encourage you to work with the DOT in these issues because they are the agency that all of us depend on. But I think that we all have to be responsible, we as contractors, we as taxpayers, and the decision makers in the state of Minnesota. I appreciate this time that you've given me.
Thank you, and I think now we can say it's a jobs bill, a rural development bill, and a green bill.
Green bill.
It's a green. The recycling. I hope I didn't just doom your bill.
Oh, yeah.
And I also want to say that I had an opportunity to tour Kandy, Ojai County, and Representative John Gisbell, and I believe we stopped in Spicer for lunch, as I recall.
Spicer's nicer.
That's right. So we had a nice visit to your town.
And Mr. Chair, just again, back to the bill, you know, some of the questions they have, and I agree with MnDOT and working with Mr. Burris, for example, on all contracts for an applicable project. Well, what is an applicable project, you know? We don't mean this for a strip of Highway 94 that's being rebuilt a mile or two that's, you know, would go from pavement to asphalt to pavement again or those types of things. So we're, again, willing, as we roll forward, to have the asphalt people that are in the room today and MnDOT and others craft language that works for both of them. And my commitment, Mr. Chair, to you and the committee is, as this moves forward, I'm not going to take it up or offer an amendment or anything else till we have the language in place that that we're satisfied with.
Thank you. And Representative Junkie, I apologize for this. I just got word from our fiscal staff that apparently MnDOT does have a fiscal note that they're working on. I was not aware of that.
They're working on or have done?
Apparently, it is not completed. Is that correct? And maybe Ms. Zeros, I don't even have a sense of what why there would be a fiscal note. Oh. So maybe you could enlighten us on that. This is news to me, Representative Jockey.
Mr. Chair and members, I spoke with MnDOT this afternoon, and there will be costs related to this bill. There are two different issues. The first is related to the effective date of the bill, which MnDOT said that if that was changed, there would be the opportunity probably to reduce some of the costs, only because they would have to change their bidding process in order to, if the bill was effective the day following enactment. But they also said that there were some additional costs as well related to the bill, and I didn't get additional information
on
that.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I'm very interested in working with MnDOT and discovering what onerous costs could be involved with this, so I'm happy to go to finance and make a stop there if you feel that's best. And we're developing language anyway, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That did also pique my curiosity as well. Representative Holdrege, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, and just to Representative Junkie, I can see a lot of problems with your effective date. You know, so work with MnDOT on bids sent out after, you know, November 1st, or you really can't, in the middle of a bid process, change the standard.
Well, again, Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair, I agree with that, and that's why I think it's not the effective date, but it's the language above. What's an applicable project? We've got to make it clear it's for any project after the effective date that's going to their table after that, that hasn't been started, that isn't in the middle of a bid process, that hasn't been drawn up yet. But from effective date forward, everything that comes, now they're going to rebuild the road in Lakeville. After that, they're just starting. Now they do the alternative bid process. So, and I think Mr. Dunick might want to weigh in too again, Mr. Chair. So I agree with you, but we'll work on the language.
Just to answer your question, probably could clarify it some, is that the there's a surface determination that comes out from the DOT on just about every major project in the state. Which way it's going to go. So that's usually a year or maybe 2 years ahead of the time it's constructed.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Dunick, I'm well aware of that.
Okay.
The point is that if you have an effective date and you have bids that are due 2 days after the effective date, it's not even workable.
No, we're not about that.
That's right.
And we'll work with that, Mr. Chair. That's not a problem.
Okay. Members, I think we have our information. Is there anyone in the audience that would want to testify in favor or in opposition? Okay, we have.
Mr. Chair, members
from
of
MnDOT.
The committee, I'm Kurt Turgeon from MnDOT, and I just want to make sure that, first of all, you realize that MnDOT does support the use of alternate bids. We have been working on doing alternate bids the last couple of years. One of the costs that we did come across in projects we let last year, a couple of small projects, is we did try and detail out all the information to do a concrete pavement and all the information to do an asphalt pavement. That is an additional amount of effort to put a plan together. We're letting two projects this year where we're trying to streamline that design, not provide as much detailed information on this set of plans. We have gotten some negative feedback from some of the contractors looking at those plans or that concept saying, well, we like it the old way, but the old way would be more work and more cumbersome for MnDOT. You know, we just got the language yesterday, and it was a lot of questions of just how widespread. We don't even know for sure ourselves how widespread we would want to use alternate bids. You know, there's a lot of details from the grading industry, from the concrete industry, from the asphalt industry that they want to see included in this process. And I guess I just want to note, even though we are encouraging it, we are moving forward, Federal Highway Administration standard policy right now is they strongly discourage using alternate bids. They won't really answer why, but I think a lot of it is because the devil's in the details when you do these things at the time of bid, and they like to have all this thing figured out ahead of time before you're letting the project.
Thank you, Mr. Turgeon. Mr. Turgeon, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turgeon, I know that it depends on the project, great variances perhaps in what it costs, but could you give us a ballpark? I mean, what is the cost of doing this plan that you're saying affects the fiscal note?
You know, I really don't have a good handle on how much extra time and effort in the design squads are doing, or, you know, some of these that were being done with consultants to see how many extra days are on the extra plan sheets. I don't have a good handle on that. I think the big concern we had was this timing of and having to go back and redo any plans that may have been already on the shelf. And I think that's something we need to work out and, you know, Representative Junkie and just how we can do that.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Junkie,
to that point, and again, we concur with MnDOT, we don't want to interrupt what's going on. This is for new stuff coming forward. But number two, I'd encourage them, too, if they're doing a fiscal note, to also do the cost savings that may be realized in the alternative bid process when you're bringing more bidders to the table. And we think there's millions of dollars, maybe per project out there, cost savings, too, which would more than outweigh any design cost concerns.
Okay, and members, just keep in mind, our jurisdiction is on the policy piece here, and, you know, the issues around the fiscal note and cost savings and
Mr. Chair, to the policy, I think you've heard from MnDOT and others, everyone agrees with the policy.
And the issue on the effective date will be fixed and dealt with, so, you know, we have that assurance from Representative Junkie. So, you know, it sounds to me that, you know, we've dealt with the policy here, the finance piece will be dealt with in Representative Leaders Committee. So is there any further discussion? We'll just have to amend the motion, though, to send it to finance instead of the general register. Yes, Mr. Turgeon.
Once we fix the language, that would greatly impact the need or not need of a fiscal note. So I don't know how that affects things in the long term, but if we know when and how widespread we're going to be expected to implement this, I think that would fix a lot of the questions regarding how we need to proceed with a fiscal note.
Yeah. Well, I think that can be addressed between now and finance. I think either way we do need to go to finance. So, and of course that'll depend on your discussions. So, okay, members, is there any further discussion of House File 3334? Then I will renew my motion that House File 3334 be recommended to pass and now sent to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, we're making good time, and I appreciate that. Let's continue on with Representative Nelson, our pal from the Finance Committee. I will move your bill, House File 3168, and we will recommend that to pass and be sent on to the State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee, of which you are a member. So I think you'll get a good hearing there as well. So Representative Nelson, File 3168.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have with me Tim Werke from the AGC, who will help me with this. The bill was brought to me by the AGC, and there's a work in your packet. There should be a list of members that were on this work group that worked on this. But the issue here is Minnesota Pilot Escort Steering Committee. The issue here is right now the need that we have here is for a uniform standard of oversized loads. Currently, if they're an escort vehicle with the oversized load and they'd have to turn or stop traffic to do a turn or something, currently they're in violation of the law when they do that. They do not have the authority to do that. Right now, the only people that have that authority would be the state patrol or a licensed peace officer to stop traffic and direct traffic. What we're trying to do here is set up a standard process so that when these loads go from state to state, there's a standard process across the state line so that these escort cars could follow the loads. And with that, like I said, I'll pass the explanation over to Mr. Werke.
Yeah, welcome to the committee, Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, good evening. My name is Tim Warkey. I'm the Highway Division Director for the Associated General Contractors, and I'm pleased to have Representative Nelson carry this bill on our behalf. I need to point out, as Representative Nelson did, that there was a steering committee working on this for about 18 months or so. We call it the Pilot and Escort Car Steering Committee. And this is really an industry initiative that came about of our own accord. And it's, as you look at that list of membership, and you'll see that it's tried to be broad-based and inclusive, and including folks to be part of this group that were affected or could be affected by any of these changes. And as Representative Nelson, I think, pointed out, currently there is no standard for training. Again, no standard for training in terms of operating these escort cars, pilot cars, if you will. You'll also see in your packet there's a photograph. This is a photograph that I took about a month ago at a service station on a Saturday. I happened to be filling up, and I noticed this vehicle. And it ends up being a pilot car from out of state that is about a 1996 Dodge Caravan. And you can see the lettering on it in terms of the placarding, in terms of the lighting bar, in terms of other things. It looks a little slipshod, if I might say. And what we're trying to do here with this steering committee, again, was to put forward a protocol for best practices. And we've spent 16 months developing that protocol, and I think you have in your packet a stapled, thicker document, and that serves as our foundational document that we call basically our template. And this template document defines those protocols, everything from what type of graphic the lettering should say on the vehicle to the lighting requirements and standards, to the protocols for communication between the cars, between the load driver, et cetera, et cetera. And what we hope to be able to do is to utilize that template in the rulemaking process, because what this bill really does is two things. It provides that a rulemaking be established for the development of these standards for training and certification. And secondly, there is a provision in the bill that would change the statutory authority for a pilot car operator who acts as a flag person when moving this load to actually manage and control traffic. Because as Representative Nelson noted, right now, and I think all of you have seen this occur, you get behind a big piece of equipment and it's turning into a job site or somewhere, someone steps out of that car or that truck and gets out there with a flag and starts stopping traffic, or maybe just puts his hand up. He might have a safety vest on, he might not. Right now, that function is illegal. Those folks do not have that authority to do that. So we're trying to establish that within the confines of this bill. I need to say a few things about current levels of authority, because currently you have three levels of escorting authority. You have a licensed peace officer, which has the ability to escort these loads, and they do so when they encroach into traffic lanes. You are required to have a licensed peace officer. The second is an entity called an LPA, or a licensed protective agent, which is a licensure that is secured through the private detective board right now. And these folks, with their LPA licenses, do a number of other things, including pilot and escort car services, but they may do for-hire security for events or for facilities or those types of things. They mainly conduct security services, but escorting is also a provision of what they do. And then lastly, there are the private carriers. That's the folks who I represent, the construction companies and other folks that have their own equipment and their own employees that manage and move this equipment around. And let me tell you, right now, my 17-year-old son could go to work tomorrow for one of our members, and next Monday morning they could put him in a pickup truck and say, help escort this big bulldozer from point A to point B. And we think that's inherently unsafe. It's a void that needs to be filled, and we hope that this effort will get us to that point. Lastly, the training. How are we going to conduct this training? The State Patrol has been, their Commercial Vehicle Services unit has been a part of our steering committee. We have worked with the State Patrol, and they have been agreeable to the fact that they would be amenable to conducting the training similar to the way that they currently now conduct their commercial vehicle annual inspection program, something about 10 years ago that was put into a place that a very easy standard to implement and to conduct. My point of view in all of this was that that training needed to be low cost so that our members could get this training and be safe, and it needed to be easily accessible. And we think through this model that the patrol would deploy, we would be able to get there. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, it would be unfair for me to finish my remarks without pointing out that if there is some element of disagreement within our group on some of the provisions as it relates to the flagging and controlling of traffic. And I think you'll hear from those folks in a minute, but we believe within our group that we can manage those concerns and that we can address those concerns in the rulemaking process. And we think this bill is something that needs to occur given what we anticipate only to be ever-increasing a number and volume of oversized and over-dimension loads that travel our states in highways. So,
okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Werke, and then we'll have a couple of people testify. But, members, we want to continue with moving relatively briskly through our hearing here. So I will, is there anyone that wants to testify in opposition to House File 3168?
Mr. Chair?
Yep. I see ya. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman Horstein, my name is Dwight Patterson. I am the owner of Pats LLC. We are a licensed protective agent subject to the Department of Public Safety's criteria. A little background, I was spent 16 years as in a EMS field, 3 years as a Hubbard County Deputy Coroner before I started my business back in 2000. According to the Minnesota statutes 326-338, it says a person engaged as a private detective or protective agent, subdivision 4, a person who for a fee, reward, or other valuable consideration undertakes any of the following acts is considered to be engaged in the business of private detective protective agent. Subdivision 4, controlling motor traffic on public streets, roads, and highways for the purpose of escorting a funeral procession and oversized loads. So there is a statute already enacted by the Minnesota state that says you can control traffic on public streets and roadways if you get a protective agent license, which I had to go through and pick up in the year 2000. I started the paperwork in 1999. The Board of Private Detective, as I said, falls under Commissioner Michael Campion's department. And there are two types of license. You have a protective agent license, which, Tim, you can do private security. And you also have what's called an escort-only license that the board gives out to individuals who want to do nothing but escorting oversized loads. But I'm not opposing the certification portion of this bill. What I'm opposing is giving that traffic control to civilians from out of state who may not be upheld to the level of training that my company does. I mean, sure, there's some states, I have a Utah certification for escorting. They taught us how to set up to escort oversized loads. They did not teach you how to control the traffic. They told you how far to be out in front, how far out in back, what type of equipment you have to have in your vehicle. By allowing other individuals to control traffic because they're an escort driver, you're going to be putting us out of business. And another question you have to ask is the liability. If the MnDOT puts down the permit that the escort driver must be certified, what certification program are they relying about or talking about? Is the liability going to have to fall back on the state if that escort driver causes an accident or if is involved in an accident? So, like I say, there's the wording of this bill, especially the traffic control, is my concern. Mr. Chair, fellow representatives, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Are there questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Patterson. So you work occasionally as an escort driver then?
Yes, sir. 90% of our business is escorting oversized loads.
Representative Erdahl.
Chair Hornstein, Mr. Patterson, maybe Representative Nelson, is there a shortage of escort drivers in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is not a shortage of escort drivers here in the state of Minnesota. A lot of them will pick up a load in Texas or Washington and bring them on through Minnesota. Or that may be an escort from Pennsylvania picks up a load and he's going out to Oregon. He'll come through Minnesota. No, there is not a shortage of escorts in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Patterson or Representative Nelson, just so I understand the process. So someone's an escort from Texas, an escort driver, can just cross state lines and keep driving and no matter what the certification or education was in Texas.
Mr. Patterson. Or Representative Nelson or Mr.
My understanding, and that's part of what my understanding is what we're trying to do here, is that trying to get a standardized training or standardized certificate that can cross state lines if a load like that happens, so that we can be trust and rely on that this certification is the same in Minnesota as it is in Iowa and all the way down to Texas, so that those people that are escorting those people here would meet the same standards as we have set in our state.
Okay. Is there any additional discussion? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, it sounds like Department of Public Safety is issuing certificates under another section of law. Is that taken into account in your bill?
Mr. Werke?
I do not believe so. I think that's what they're looking at here is that everybody that does this will have to get the certificate, whether you're the licensed patrol officer, the agents, whether you're the higher patrol, whether you're local police, if you're going to be stopping and controlling traffic, you'd have to getting that training through the MnDOT and the state patrol.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, Tim Werke again. Maybe to clarify, we're not changing anything with respect to the requirements that would dictate whether or not an escort is needed to move a load. That remains the function of the permit. So when a load that requires a permit would come to MnDOT, MnDOT as the permitting authority would review that load and would declare that yes, this load needs an escort in order to move. Now, once this program would become in place, that load could not be escorted unless the escort had gone through the training and had received a certification. And so if in situations where there is concern about other states, if someone is moving a load from Pennsylvania to Washington State through Minnesota, by the time we would put this in place, as they would come to the Minnesota border, they would need to have and have gone through and completed our training and our certification. And we would have to develop a reciprocity type of system, which is the long-term goal here, that there be reciprocity with other states that is being worked on right now to recognize that. But I hope that answers the question a little bit.
Okay. I'm going to call on Representative Erdahl, Mason, Morrow, and then we'll move to a vote. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How long will this training program and certification take, Mr. Werke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, we would anticipate that it would be a fairly short process, modeled again after the State Patrol commercial vehicle training. You know, maybe as much as a two-day session with a test, and then you achieve the certification. It could be done in a day. I'm not sure. We haven't gotten to that point yet in terms of identifying how long, what the training is including, what it would look like. Those things, I think, will be worked out in the rulemaking.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Patterson, so why would that be a problem for you? Could you and people who work for you become certified then under their program and just keep doing what you're doing?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Riddle. Mr. Patterson.
That would be true. We could go through the certification program. However, the problem I have is giving traffic control duties to somebody from another state. As I say that right now in the state of Minnesota, the only people that are allowed to control traffic are licensed peace officers or licensed protective agents and their employees. There is a training program that Mr. Workey is talking about, and I have gone through that training given through RSA Network, which is a Utah certification program, and it is an 8-hour class. And the only requirements for taking that class is that you have a driver's license record, but it does not say if you're insured, doesn't not ask if you're bonded, which are items that are required by the state of Minnesota if you are an escort only license holder.
Yeah. Well, this may be an appropriate time. I see State Patrol folks here, and I think we're kind of speculating a little on some of the regulations. So let's get it straight from the source. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Urquhart. I'm the commander of the Commercial Vehicle Enforcement Unit for the State Patrol. And I believe that the existing training that was referred to has been in existence for 20 years and was developed as what we call our mandatory inspection program for commercial vehicles. And basically what we do is we train representatives in the industry, truck repair folks, truck dealerships, motor carrier officials to conduct their own annual inspections in accordance with federal regulation and state law. And we provide a certification. We train them initially. They're certified, and every 2 years they come back through one of our affiliated partnership technical colleges to be recertified. So the initial training for the mandatory inspection program, as an example, is approximately 8 hours, and then the recert period is less than four. And basically we keep track of who's certified and make sure that they're conducting those inspections appropriately.
Okay, that's helpful. Representative Holberg, then Representative Mason, and then we will vote.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but currently if an oversized load comes through the state of Minnesota, do they need a Minnesota-certified escort? I hear the gentleman talking about not wanting people from other states. What currently happens with these loads as they enter and leave our state?
Officer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, there's two standards, basically. If the load is wide enough to infringe on oncoming traffic, then MnDOT, through policy, requires that peace officers escort that load, whether it's state troopers, local officers, whoever that may be. If the load does not infringe on oncoming traffic, then and escorts are required in compliance with the permit that's issued. Any number of folks can provide the escort. There is no standard for them. There's no training. There's no standard. And the industry approached both the departments, Department of Public Safety and MnDOT, to ask us to participate in this process to make some recommendations to establish some minimal standards for those folks that are going to escort their equipment. Now, I do know the industry has interest about it. Some of these folks want to escort their own equipment because they move their own equipment from time to time. And they feel they have the best knowledge of their equipment, and they feel that with proper training, they'd like to move their equipment.
But just
Representative Holberg.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification purposes, so from what you said, currently people from other states are, in fact, providing the escort in the second instance and may or may not have any type of certification other than the permit that they get from MnDOT, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
And so, just follow up, so related to the gentleman's concerns, if in fact Minnesota puts in some standards, would he not maybe have the ability to have more business with loads coming through Minnesota if they did not have somebody with the right certification? They might have to hire a Minnesota business to escort their load across the state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess if I was in the business today and I knew this was coming, I'd make sure I was the first one to be certified and I would be prepared to escort those loads.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. And then we'll take a question from Representative Mason and then we'll conclude the hearing on this bill.
Mr. Chair, whoever would like to answer this, and it's probably a follow-up to what Representative Holberg has been talking about. Okay, so right now, somebody's going from Ohio to California. That person goes straight through our state, regardless of whether they know our laws or not. If we pass this, and again, say it's a company in Ohio, they come to Minnesota, and their person is not trained, they will have to have somebody from Minnesota take it across the state, or else they can't go through the state. Is that what will happen?
Officer Urquhart? Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's happening today. There are states with standards in place today. And whenever these loads move through those states, they need to comply with those standards. So, yeah, escorts will be picked up at the state line that have to comply with that state's laws. And then, of course, once they leave that state, they can revert back to, you know, whatever escorts they'll meet the next state's laws. So it is happening. And there is a movement across the nation to set standards like this that all the states will recognize. And there's an organization called the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance that all the states belong to, and this is being discussed at that level. But what we're looking at is we're looking at what other states have done and trying to adopt some standards that other states are using.
Okay, thank you.
I believe we are fully informed about House File 3168. So do you have any concluding comments, Representative Nelson?
Just one thing is, when these standards are established, there will be hopefully reciprocity between states so that we know the people that are escorting these loads in Minnesota are certified to our standards. And with that, I'll...
Thank you very much, Representative Nelson. I will renew my motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. If you want one last word, but we really need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I'll give you one quick word here.
My question is that when the escort does enter Minnesota, how are we going to know that person is certified to Minnesota standards and whether they carry the standards Minnesota requires in insurance?
Okay.
Thank you.
Question for the record. Then, Representative Nelson, any final comments? If you want to respond to anything.
Thank you for your support.
Okay. So I'm renewing my motion that House File 3168 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. Thank you very much. And we have two more bills on the agenda for the members of the audience. We're going to take House File 3075, Representative Severson, and then we'll conclude our evening with Representative Champion's bill, House File 3099. Thank you, everybody, for your patience, and I believe we can move relatively quickly through these last two bills. At least that's my hope. Let's do the minutes now, get that out of the way. Representative Erdahl moves the minutes for our meeting on March 4th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Severson, your bill is going to the Finance Committee. I believe we have gotten word that there is some fiscal... No, it's in the packet, actually, members. Dated February 23rd, fiscal note. So I will move that House File 3075 be recommended to pass and then be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. Welcome back to the committee. Well, I'm a transportation guy, too. I can't keep track.
Yeah, a long time ago, I was on this committee. It was last biennium, yeah. Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we'll try and make this fairly quick. But I think the essence of the bill is currently we have proposals that are put before our local governments to have economic development take place. And as that takes place, MnDOT actually has the final say on whether or not these positioning of these entryways into these areas is going to work for them or is not going to work for them. And I've got a gentleman here who is working on a piece of economic development in the area, and it's about $10 million worth of economic development and currently has been quelled by MnDOT's policy. What this provision, what this bill basically does is it says, you know, local governments have a vested interest in how they develop the particular area. If MnDOT has a problem with that, then MnDOT needs to be able to step up to the plate and say, here are three particular examples of where we believe that this safety issue that we are raising to preclude that development from taking place, we have three examples that show why that should not take place. And the essence of this bill, Mr. Chair and members, is that local government is local government and should have control. And whenever we have statewide government begin to infringe upon economic development, we have a problem because I think it reaches beyond the purview of that. Now, there will be some discussion here, but first off, I'd like Mr. Klein to go ahead and present his case, and then we will move on from there.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Klein. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Frank Klein. Mr. Chairman and representatives, 5.5 years ago, I purchased a development piece of property at the junctions of Highway 15 and Benton County Road 29 in Sartell, Minnesota. The corner is controlled by stoplights and left turn arrows, very properly controlled corner. The first year, we put up a upscale 13,500 square foot retail center on the property, and since then we've been contacted by two major oil companies and a Culver's restaurant to move in on the two most forward lots abutting Highway 15. After the C-Store gas stations and Culver's did their research and whatnot, they both chose to move on because of the poor access that we have to that development. So I approached the St. Cloud MnDOT office and met with the supervisors to see if it would be possible to put in a right turn only lane into our development. And after a couple different meetings, you know, it all came down to the same answer, and that would be no. If you look at the very first page on your handout, the area in yellow is the piece of property that's in question. And what we want to do is put in a turn lane before our retail center, which you'll see a little later on. But the turn lane would be approximately 220 feet long. And I was told by MnDOT, well, that's not a safe feature to have that size of a turn lane. But yet, if you go through your handout, you'll notice that there are turn lanes that are 240 feet in length. There are turn lanes, the second one on Highway 15 and 3rd Street North is by Crossroads Shopping Center, a much more heavily traveled intersection than the one that is at question. And they have a right turn lane going into a retail area that's only 150 feet long. It's worked out very well for them. The next page shows a right turn lane that's only 75 feet long and hasn't been a major concern. I'd like to point out that development leads into a gas station, C-store, and a movie theater. And 75 feet, that development is only 5 years old at the maximum. And then the second to the last page again shows our development, and my access road is 900 feet back from Highway 15. And you can see our retail building pretty much in the center of that development. And the last page will show the proposed layout of the right turn only lane servicing a C-store in the development area. The MnDOT owns the easement rights. When Highway 15 and 29 were restructured, they bought the easement rights when they purchased some of the extra land from the Pogansky family. And talking with the Pogansky family, they truly didn't understand at that time what that really entailed by giving up those easement rights. And right now, it basically is holding up development on that property. We've got many interested people that want to move in there, yet if a right turn lane only can be obtained.
And Mr. Chair and members, and to that issue, when we're talking about the overlook here, this is the potential use of the future property is currently vacant. This is the retail property that's looking to go into this particular area. And I think one of the issues that I think is paramount to this is that we have land that is not being accessed, is not being utilized to the best possible use in terms of tax revenue for our particular district. We're being restricted from being able to develop this and create a tax base. And it's solely at the behest of one state agency, MnDOT, which is determining whether or not we can actually do the economic development.
Okay, well, I had a feeling that Representative Leader would have a few concerns about this. So Representative Leader and then Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have a series of questions.
Sure.
Mr. Klein, yes. When you purchased this land, was that open land?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, no, it was not. The roadway was in.
No, but I mean, were there other buildings and stuff in it?
There was one other building, yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Klein,
Leader.
You referred to these other turn lanes, distances. Can you tell me the traffic speed on each one of those? What's the traffic speed like at the Crossroads Shopping Center? That's 30 miles an hour, isn't it?
I believe it.
What's the speed in this where you're at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe the speed limit is 35 miles an hour on 3rd Street. The speed limit at our crossing is 40 miles an hour. And I went online to find out what a safe stopping distance would be at a car for a car going 40 miles an hour. And research from the Highway Traffic and Safety Engineers Council shows that at 40 miles an hour, the braking or deceleration of a car, the average vehicle out there is 76 feet. The reaction distance, however, is 88 feet. So you add the two together, a car going 40 miles an hour to come to a dead stop needs 164 feet.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klein, when you bought that land, though, were the highway easements in place?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they were.
So now with the crow, Mr. Chair, Mr. Klein, the controlled access was in place when you bought the land.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, it was.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Holbrook, and we also have a, how about having MnDOT, we have a representative from MnDOT here, I believe.
Right.
I don't know, what was your question to Mr. Klein? Or?
Well, I mean, I kind of just wanted to make a statement. We have a road in our region called County Road 42 in which the locals were allowed to allow many, many accesses onto a road that was paid for largely, you know, by dollars paid for by all taxpayers. The end result is that road no longer serves the function that it was built for. And I don't know how far out in the country you are or whatever, but the reality is that we put in certain classes of roads to fulfill a function, that is to move traffic. And every time we add a new driveway or an access or whatever, we add conflict points, we slow down traffic, and we now have a road in Dakota and Scott County that should be able to move lots of traffic. That's what its original intent was, but because there is so much cross movement and intersections and driveways and turn lanes, anybody that drives one end of that road to the other doesn't have a clue what the area is like, because they would avoid that at all costs because it is so dysfunctional. So while it's no fun to have Big Brother dictate accesses onto roads. The reality is these different roads serve functions of mobility, and safety is a factor, and your bill is extremely broad in how it is written. I think it's probably in conflict with some of the rules about MnDOT land and having to get a fair price for it if they turn it over to somebody else. But the reality is that we have to protect the functionality of our road system. Otherwise, we end up having to, like in Dakota County, they're searching for another east-west corridor to build because County Road 42 is so far beyond any ability to fix at this point, and was in large part a result of the locals being allowed time after time to increase accesses on a road.
And Mr. Chair, through Representative Holberg's point, I think the issue becomes, it'd be great to build roads and just say you can get from point A to point B, and there shouldn't be any off-ramps on that. It creates an even flow of traffic, but the problem with that is roads are created for commerce. Roads are infrastructure. Roads are part of our economic development tool. And so when we begin to restrict those simply because we want traffic to move faster or freer, we're really restricting economic development. We're restricting the ability for people to get to the place of business in a convenient way.
But, Mr. Chair, it shows here that he does have access to this property from a form of what we now call a backage road. We're not building frontage roads anymore because you only get tax base on one side of the road. That's why they're building backage roads, so that you can get tax base on both sides of them. So they've tried to address that issue as well.
Representative Severson, we have MnDOT anxious to weigh into, but I don't know, Representative Severson, if you wanted to respond to that last comment.
Yeah. And I guess probably the process in which this has been disputed is the fact that the gas stations won't go in there because it takes more than two right-hand turns. And because of the market forces that are driven on this thing, if you require them to go around it, they will not. You're not going to drive into a gas station that takes three blocks to get there. And so there's the whole issue of economic and smart development that we need to take into account here, which I believe that this bill brings that into perspective.
Right, but just 1 second, I have to.
Holberg and that.
But Representative Severson, you get to a point where people won't go on a road anymore, and the commerce in that area is negatively affected. Around Christmas, it's faster for me to go from Lakeville to Southtown than trying to transverse certain portions of County Road 42 and all the traffic and the mess that's there.
And okay, my Representative Morrow has a.
Well, I do. I'm trying to figure out, and maybe this follows from Representative Holberg, whether Representative Severson, you've hit on something that I should be using in my district, because I want to get a development done on Highways 14, gentlemen, and MnDOT, and 41. And I'm wondering whether this would now, if I could use this bill to require that interchange be built for economic development purposes. And I'm wondering also, who's going to pay for either that interchange or this project if this bill goes through? I'm worried about what does this do to the STIP? What's this do to funding within districts?
Representative Severson, and then MnDOT.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Morrow, and Mr. Klein has volunteered to pay for this entire project himself for this economic development. It costs nothing to the state.
Well, let's hear from the state. Mr. Povich, I believe.
That would be me.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. We've had a lot thrown out here, so I want to have you respond to what you've heard.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Povich. I'm the Assistant District Engineer for MnDOT District 3, which is central Minnesota, and I work out of our St. Cloud office, which is just a couple miles from this intersection, and I'm here to testify obviously against this bill tonight. As a way of introduction, I just want to mention that I do have 40 years of engineering experience, and it has not all been with the bureaucracy in that. For much of my career, I have worked in private practice for developers like Mr. Klein all over the United States, working on shopping centers and other developments to get them access to the public highway system. And whether I was working in the private sector or the public sector, I've always tried to perform my function in a safe manner
and that's what this is about. The situation that we're talking about here in Sartell, and I am a resident of Sartell, I drive through this intersection almost every day. This is a major signalized intersection in the St. Cloud area. It accommodates 30,000 vehicles a day, which is high volume traffic. There were a number of crashes and a fatality about 12 years ago. At that point in time, an improvement project was done at this intersection to signalize it, channelize it, purchase the access control, and build the backage road to serve this property here. And all those plans were done out and open and in cooperation with both the city and the county, so they were in support of the project. And at that time, the property owner was compensated for the access control that we took along County Road 29. I met with Mr. Klein, the current owner, and Representative Sievertson on this past June 30th. And at that time, I asked Mr. Klein, when you purchased the property, did you know that there was access control along the sides of your property? And he said, yes. And I said, well, did you understand what that meant? And he says, yes, that means I don't get any driveways in that area. So he understood what he was getting into prior to even purchasing the property. Our process in our district is whenever we get a request for access to the highway, we have what's called an entrance committee. It's about a dozen people. It's real estate people and traffic engineers, and they go through each request and look at it to see if it can be approved. And the vast majority of those requests are approved. In this particular case here, his request for access at this location was denied due to safety concerns, number one, and number two, that the taxpayers had already purchased access control in that area. Mr. Klein, as he had a right to, appealed that decision to our new ombudsman office that Commissioner Sorrell has established, and they independently reviewed it and came to the same conclusion that the access should be denied, and they so informed him. If you ask any traffic engineer, they will tell you that access management is the number one thing you can do for safety and mobility. It's far and away more important than installing traffic signals or guardrail or anything else. Access management is a big deal, as some of you have mentioned already, what can happen if you don't have it. It's not just me. I mean, I've been portrayed as the bad guy here, as I've been previously called the one person that's stopping all this. And I'll just tell you, I mean, I have reviewed this situation with other professional engineers at the federal, state, local level, both in public and private practice, and I have not found one of them yet that would agree to allowing this access. The local county engineer, Benton County, is not in favor of this access. His local county board member is not in favor of it, and he has told me that likely if this went to the county board would not be in favor of this. City of Sartell has testified as being neutral on this issue. In summary, and thank you for giving me a few minutes to talk to you. In summary, if this legislation passes, it will result in more crashes around the state, not just this location, but other locations too. There's no question about it. And there's reams and reams of studies on access management that can be produced that all come to the same conclusion. And I'll just stop by saying, as Representative Sievertson told me in our meeting on June 30th, doing these studies, which this legislation will require, will cost MnDOT, i.e. the taxpayers, a lot of money, and you don't want to do that. So I could go on with the other studies I brought with, but I'll stop it.
You know what? Because of the hour, I think I'd want Representative Sievertson to respond, and then I have some comments I want to make about the bill as well. So why don't we do that, Representative Sievertson, and then we can begin to wrap things up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and as you read the bill, it basically gives the local authority the ability to approve or disapprove. And if MnDOT wants to usurp that, then they have to provide studies that are in fact going to show that this particular case is going to cause an increase in accidents. I don't dispute that. If MnDOT can show that in this particular instance there is going to be an increase, then produce the studies. And it says there needs to be three studies. I have some issue with
with the unilateral muscling that goes on with MnDOT throughout the state. Part of this process is it is we the people. We the people govern, particularly at the local level, and when we're dictated to by state agency, it becomes counterproductive to our economic development process. So this bill in particular was to generate the discussion to say, how much power do we give MnDOT? How much authority, unquestioned authority, do we give a single state agency that they can quell the amount of economic development that takes place in an area? So I want to, you know, with that, Mr. Chair, I understand it's a contentious issue. I wanted to get it before this committee so we could start a discussion, and hopefully we will continue this discussion in the Finance Committee. At this point, I would probably move to lay the bill over, since I don't think that I have everybody on board yet.
Okay, yeah, it is a process, Representative Severson, and I appreciate that. And you know, I guess I'll just, we had a good discussion, and I would encourage the particularly the local officials in Sartell, St. Cloud area to continue that. But I think that's probably the best.
And Mr. Chair, just one final statement, if I could.
Yes.
Now, when Mr. Povich, who was a famous painter, I might add, an artist, and a good man besides, when he said that Sartell is neutral on this issue, one of the issues that we deal with on a constant basis is the city of Sartell may come off as neutral, but that's because they have to deal with MnDOT on a daily basis. When you go crosswise with MnDOT, you still have to do projects down the road here. And so if you come off as someone who is bucking the tide, it can often have repercussions that you don't want. So that kind of lends to the bully system that is the reason that I brought this bill forward today.
Well, I'm going to Representative Leader has a final comment, and I am going to respect your wishes, Representative Severson, and we will move to lay this bill over. But Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Severson, I'm sorry you take that attitude, but I'd just like to point out one thing. If this changes, it's pretty prevalent right now that because of design standards, engineers get sued because, and as Mr. Povich pointed out, there are national standards for intersections and some of these things, and if they're deviated and if the locals want to pick up the responsibility in case there's an accident, then we better get an amendment in this bill showing the liability goes to the city of Sartell or whoever it is, or the developer, because that's exactly the nature of what's happening with safety concerns now. And if you look at the new federal legislation, it's strictly all safety. And as Representative Hoover pointed out, it may not look like an issue now, but that once you put that opening in there, that intersection is going to change from here on in. And apparently, developers like to see cars and people coming in there. So somehow there's a liability issue, and Mr. Pover should be relieved of that liability if this is changed. And I'd make sure that we pass it, because that liability shouldn't be with the state after the change in this case.
And
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't disagree with that. I think if there is founded scientific evidence, there are studies, and that's the question here, because that hasn't been presented here. There has been, you know, a number of 400, but I haven't seen any studies that document that. When Mr. Klein brought out the numbers, it said the stopping distance is 164 feet, and the proposal here is 240 feet. There's a disconnect here. Why is that a problem? So, and we could continue to debate this issue, and perhaps I will stop by Representative Leader's office, and we'll have this.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Well, that'll be a good discussion with a couple of veterans who have served our country admirably. So, with that, we'll lay the bill on the table.
Yes, Chair. Thank
you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks everybody for your patience. We're now ready to tackle our last bill of the night. Representative Champion, House File 3099. And I believe there's also a fiscal note, Representative Champion, so you can move that. Member of the committee, you can move the bill. I would recommend to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Leaders Committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House File Number 3099, and I recommend that it pass to. I recommend that it pass and go to Transportation Finance.
Okay. Thank you very much. So with that, we have House File 3099 before us. Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, I think that it would be important for me to contextualize this particular bill and why this particular bill is before us. What occurred is, during this past summer, Congressman Ellison and I and a number of other key stakeholders had a town hall meeting. And there were a series of meetings that were held in order to understand what are the challenges facing disadvantaged businesses. And once we looked at that information, along with my senator, who is Senator Linda Higgins, we decided to come up with this legislation. This legislation is not, number one, to set any goals. It is already law that MnDOT, especially when they receive federal funds, that there are goals that must be established and there must be an implementation in a way by which to fulfill those goals. Those goals are supposed to look at how do we help build capacity for disadvantaged businesses. So it's important that we understand that. We understand that this bill is coming from key stakeholders, but strangely enough, MnDOT has been meeting with a group of collaborators, and these are different folks who come from the industry itself, and the information or the provisions in this particular legislation is very close to what, in fact, they see as what should happen or could happen in order to foster inclusion. And in my due diligence, I also learned that the things that I'm asking for in Section 1, Section 2 pretty much, Section 3, Section 4, remain consistent with what Met Council is doing right now. Met Council is doing the very thing that we are putting on the table as a requirement, as a way to help foster inclusion for MnDOT to do. Now let me briefly just go through the bill just so that we have a clear sense of what it is. First of all, in Section 1, there is a belief that MnDOT's goals or inclusion goals can be achieved if at the time of bid solicitation that there are some requirements that folks do, such as provide as a part of their reply or response to a bid information about how they're going to, you know, seek inclusion, who are other people that they talk to, all the things that they are required to do, because federal legislation already says that there should be inclusion to reach these goals, and if you are not going to reach those goals, then you must demonstrate good faith efforts. That's already in law. That's the federal law. This will help on the front end so that MnDOT can take that information and determine if this particular bid should be given to a particular contractor, because they'll look at a number of different things, including and not limited to materials, how much things cost, the whole nine yards. Section 2 just talks about sanctions. Already, they are supposed to sanction and can sanction, but we want to make sure that it's very clear that you should sanction in the event that someone is not doing what they're supposed to do. Section 3 is around training. One of the things that the federal legislation often talks about is about how do we help build capacity. Capacity building is very important around the state. So how do we do that in real time? Well, through workshops, through a variety of different ways that MnDOT and others can think about as they aggregate and look at the information that's important in order to help support disadvantaged businesses. Section 4 talks about a report. This is the Transportation Policy and Oversight Committee. It is very important for information to come back to this committee and for us to understand what MnDOT has done. And that report must include a number of provisions that we believe to be very important. That helps MnDOT to also understand where they're falling short or where they can do better and or whether there is the right capacity out in the marketplace.
Section 5 is a section where there's been some discussion, and I want to highlight that. Section 5 is about, well, MnDOT could potentially submit a request to the Federal Department of Transportation and ask for the goals of women and firms of color to be separated. Now, in this particular section, I've heard of a variety of different thoughts. So one of the things that I did make a commitment to do today was to work with a number of key stakeholders around this, and how do we get to this question around not taking money away from anyone, how can we get the information and use the information in a way that supports all businesses. And so I believe that this legislation is important. It'd be helpful, and it's the right thing to do in order to move us in the right direction. This will continue to show our commitment to inclusion. We can use information to determine capacity in order to target resources. And I've also, like I said earlier, made a commitment also to MnDOT, for an example, to come and have a discussion with their collaborative group, because I believe it's important to empower groups and make whatever adjustments or amendments that we think make sense in light of keeping the spirit of this legislation going forward. And so I hope that you would support my motion to pass this bill and go to transportation finance, because there is a fiscal note. And that fiscal note, I'm sure, can be wrestled with in real time, because once MnDOT has a better sense of what we think is important and what they think is important, we can land upon a different sort of landscape in order to deal with this disadvantaged business enterprises terrain. And I stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions of the committee for Representative Champion? I know we have a number of people that would also like to testify, both in support and maybe others that have concerns. So, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion. Under the sanction provision, what type of sanctions would be imposed on contractors who don't meet these?
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, under the sanctions section, it is simply to say that sanction could be put forward, such as, you know, maybe that they don't get another contract, or they have to demonstrate some things. There could be liquidated damages. It could be some things in order to say, hey, if you gave us your word and you got this contract based on you giving us your word, then we want to make sure that you do exactly what you tell us that you're going to do. But there could be some circumstances where there are extenuating circumstances. That's just to make sure that information is there and that they have the power to do that, and not say that it is appropriate in every case. And so I would also leave that to what's already in the federal regulations in order to talk about what sanctions could be done.
Mr. Chairman. Representative
Mr. Champion, Representative Champion. Are there specific federal sanctions? I mean, it seems very broad, from a slap on the wrist to something more major under what you said, but is there a federal sanction that's more specific?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a variety of different things. Like, for an example here, a sanction could mean just, you know, monitoring the contract throughout, making sure that they do exactly what it is that they say that they're going to do. It could be a liquidated data damage. MnDOT would look squarely at 49 CFR in order to see exactly what those liquidated damages could be or what sanctions could be.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Champion, could the sanctions in your bill exceed any federal standards or federal sanctions?
Representative Champion.
Chairman, Representative Erdahl, no.
Representative Erdahl, do you have any further questions? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Champion, and this actually may be a question for you and or Mr. Burris. I'm looking at lines 3.1, 3.2. This is about the business development workshops. And Representative Champion, my question kind of cuts both ways. First, it's indicated in documents that one of these workshops was held in Detroit Lakes, which is not a metropolitan area. At the same time, I wonder about Mankato, which has recently been designated as a metropolitan statistical area. So I'm wondering about this language in various metropolitan area locations. Do you need this language? Is it necessary? Can you omit in various metropolitan statistical locations, maybe even just say throughout the state? Because I'm worried that you're either cutting off or over-including some areas.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merle, I think you're absolutely right. We are not trying to limit any particular place or space because we want to make sure that there is workshops and training and development and capacity building. So I would entertain a change there.
Representative Morrow.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I would offer an amendment to lines 3.1, 3.2, to on 3.1, delete the words in various. And on lines 3.2, to delete the words metropolitan area locations. And I think I'm comfortable leaving it at that, unless other members want to think that I should put throughout the state, but I'm comfortable just omitting those words. That would be my motion.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say throughout the state because I don't want just the training to happen, let's say, in St. Paul, and therefore disadvantage the folks in rural Minnesota. I want there to be some thinking around intentionally wanting to train and educate folks throughout the state of Minnesota.
Then, Mr. Chair, what I'll do, I'll withdraw the amendment, and my amendment will be on lines 3.1, remove the words in various, lines 3.2, metropolitan area locations, and insert in that place throughout the state.
Okay. Members, does everyone have that oral amendment? It's very clear, it's straightforward. However, I just wanted to see, Mr. Burris, when we say throughout the state, does that commit MnDOT to either a certain number or geographical representation for these workshops at all, that language?
Mr. Chair and members, I would suggest that it provides some direction to MnDOT, both in the context of the discussion here and in the language, that it would not be specific to a particular locale, and they would have some discretion and determining the balance on that.
That's helpful. Is there any discussion to the Morrow oral amendment? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make one other oral amendment.
Okay.
I would like to delete subdivision 2, which is right at 2.15 to 2.20.
Okay, that's a reduction of contract goal. Do you want to explain your oral amendment to the committee?
A reason for that is because I think and believe that on the front end of the contract is only awarded if there is a clear determination and demonstration of meeting the goals or providing good faith efforts, and that's a part of the criteria, and therefore there would be no need to have that particular subdivision because it contradicts what we're really trying to accomplish.
Okay. Discussion of the proposal amendment. Again, I'll repeat it. It is deleting page 2, lines 15 through 20, and that's subdivision 2 of section 1.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Morrow.
If I might just suggest for Representative Champion, that's also included on line 2.21, renumbering sub 3 to make it sub 2, I believe.
Good catch there.
Thank you.
So we'll include that as in the body of that oral amendment. Is there discussion? Okay. All those in favor, again, of the Morrow oral amendment, the Morrow Champion oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, yes.
I think there's somebody in the audience.
Oh, does anyone want to speak to the amendment? Okay. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
I didn't see you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And again, we're speaking to the amendment, not testifying on the bill specifically.
My name is Troy Parker, and I think the reason I would speak probably against the amendment is because currently there's no real procedure in place when contractors aren't meeting the goal or aren't having clear documentation of their good faith effort. So I think having this waiver still in place in that part of the bill also documents whether or not the good faith effort has in fact taken place, and it allows MnDOT then the levity to decide whether or not to actually grant or deny the contract to be awarded based on not meeting the effort or goals. So this is the actual enforcement mechanism portion of that language in the contract.
Okay. I'll defer to the author of the bill for any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. The reason why I believe that language is not necessary is because on the front end, we require bid solicitation, and a part of the bid solicitation is a plan around inclusion, which also requires the submitting company to articulate exactly what they've done, and they must do so, exactly what they've done in order to foster inclusion, and that's a part of the contract consideration. If they have not done that, then they will not get the contract in the first place. So that makes that language not necessary, because that trigger and that protection is already on the front end of the front end of the process.
Okay. Is there any further discussion to the Champion amendment, which is to delete lines 15 through 20 and change subdivision 3 to subdivision 2 on line 21? Yes, it appears as if we have one more member of the public that would like to testify, and then we're going to move to a vote on this amendment. Please, Chairman, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Lenny Chisholm, Springboard Economic Development. I posed this exact question to MnDOT yesterday to find and produce a waiver application, so that I would understand what this meant when they were not requiring a contractor to meet goals on a project. It was determined that the combination of documents which brought in some ambiguity as to how they grant the waivers. I also questioned the FHWA as to the process for this, and their leadership informed me that under the plan, stewardship plan, that we have agreement with FHWA and MnDOT to operate, that this is one of their concerns, is that the waivers are being granted without enough oversight. And they were determining whether they should now remove the or enhance MnDOT's ability, or remove it, in this case, and remove MnDOT's ability to just grant those waivers and bring it to the FHWH level, so that they would no longer have that carte blanche way to grant these waivers. So I think that is extremely important language, because it's already there, but it also enforces what's already one of the issues that we're sitting in a collaborative regarding, is why are there so many waivers if there's a 5% goal and the contractor turns in less than that, what is actually occurring. So I think that is strong language, and I would encourage that we keep as many of those that verbiage in there to assist us in reaching the goals.
Okay, is there any further discussion of the author's amendment? Okay, anyone in the audience, the public, that wants to weigh in further on the author amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. We have the bill, I think, in the shape that you'd like it in now?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you
okay.
so much.
Okay. We have a number of people that would like to testify on the bill as a whole now. So I will just call the names as, again, if I don't call your name, just wave and we'll have you come up and testify. First on the list is Lewis King from Summit Academy. Mr. King, welcome to our committee. Good to see you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And thank you for having me tonight. I want to thank Representative Champion for inviting me. You may not recall, but was March 8th last year, 12 months ago on a day, that I appeared in this chamber with the members of Higher Minnesota and the students of Summit Academy OIC. And I think it's appropriate that I appear today in support of this measure because it somewhat represents, if you will, a battle handoff. I am, as you will recall, more involved in workforce issues, and for the last 12 months have waged a campaign both of protest, which has now shifted to dialogue and collaborative work with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, contractors, and labor. I would be remiss if I did not say that next Monday I am taking Bernie Arsenault to breakfast. He's taken me twice, so the score is 2-1 at this point in terms of success. But I am here to, first of all, say that we've been involved in this collaborative process. And as you may recall, I was not a supporter of it on the onset, and we basically made our voices heard. On the workforce side, we made tremendous progress. Unfortunately, that progress has yet to be translated to the DBE side. But I think we're going to find most people in support of this measure. We are, as I stated in the Senate hearing today, cautiously optimistic because even as we debate these measures, MnDOT continues to let projects under the same procedures. So we don't have a lot of time to waste. We do need to be about bringing change as quickly as possible. I support the efforts of my colleagues in the collaborative. I support the people who are working together in good faith. And I think that what this does is raise the ante on the debate that we have to get something done. We can't sit back. Time is not on our side. So you're going to hear from folks tonight who are a lot smarter than I am about the details of what needs to be done. But in the spirit of working together, I don't think that this measure will hurt us. And we'll probably come again next year or probably sometime in the fall and bring you up to speed on our progress. And if necessary, we'll call upon your assistance prior to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. King. Are there any questions of the testifier? And thank you for your efforts. We have Mr. Chisholm, Mr. Parker, Reverend Slack, Mr. Workey, and Mr. Blanks on the list. And if there's anyone else, please notify us about that. Okay, I see that we'll have one more in addition. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Chisholm.
Thank you. Chairman, I would like to ingratiate Representative Champion for his courage in bringing this bill forward. When America decided to rebuild this country, they decided to do it through construction jobs and construction companies. They did that during the Great Depression years, and they are now attempting to do it again. This legislation allows for such companies to be developed inside the minority communities. It also takes into account that tax dollars are collected in a non-discriminatory fashion. Unfortunately, we have not been able to get those tax dollars to be used for contracts in the same way. What this comes down to is that we're taking this community and saying we want to put jobs that have dirty shoes, dirty pants, construction hats, construction vests within this community. I started my thoughts and then I went over and I said we need to look at making this an all-inclusive process. I sat down with Commissioner Sorrell. We sat down with Commissioner Sorrell over 18 months ago, and all of the things that are in this bill we asked, and I'm so happy and my organization is so happy that we are seeing some movement, because at this point over $600 million has been let out in MnDOT construction contracts. I have only been able to point that about $400,000 of that has went to minority companies of African American persuasion. How can we rebuild our communities with such a small amount of money? That is in essence what we're talking about here today. How do we take the rest of the country and set it aside so that we also include ours? And that's where this dirty boot legislation comes into play. Thank you for your time and listening to my comments.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Mr. Chisholm? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chisholm, if you know,
What was the amount of the dollars that went into DBEs in general? You said $400,000 to African American. Do you know?
The numbers that I've gotten from MnDOT, Chairman and Committee, is that we've only got about $18 million of this, including all minorities and women, out of the $600 million thus far, which is a paltry amount considering what this bill was supposed to do when they passed it in at the federal level. So we've only gotten about $18 million thus far. And we still have to deal with, this bill takes into effect next year's letting. We still have a considerable amount of money this year, which we have still yet to figure out how to invigorate the other communities, which is approximately, from my understanding, about $300 million.
Thank you,
Representative Fulberg, and thank you, Mr. Chisholm. Mr. Parker, I think, welcome back again.
Hey, good evening, and just thank you for allowing me to speak here today, and I want to as well thank Mr. Champion, for Representative Champion, for offering this bill. I think it really, you know, just to get into down to the basic of what this bill, I hope, would do for us is, you know, women make up about half of the population of Minnesota, and they only received about 2-3% of contracting dollars out of MnDOT. And then once you take in the minority communities as well, and as more pressure comes from these communities based on the fact that they don't believe that they receive an equal amount of or equal share of contracting opportunities and other things, we don't want to see then the pendulum swing and penalize the women DBE or the women contractors in this by us being combined in this same subgroup. So therefore, having a bill of, such as this would offer a little more, well, as for now, it would offer the women DBEs a little more protection of being against being victimized by bills or the pendulum swinging in the other direction. And I think it would include and encourage a little more participation by all community, because it would also force and encourage DBEs to do the same thing that we're asking prime contractors to do, which would be for a minority DBE to subcontract with women-owned DBE firms and companies, and vice versa. And so therefore leveling the playing field and helping create more opportunities for everyone. And I think that was the full intent of CFR 49 Part 26 at its inception. And I just, you know, once again want to thank you all for listening to us, and thank Representative Champion for, you know, bringing this bill forth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parker. Are there any questions of the committee for Mr. Parker?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I have Reverend Slack. I don't know if Mr. Blanks is here. I will have maybe the supporters testify, and then we'll hear from others. Reverend Slack, welcome back to the State Office Building.
Thank you very much, you again. Chairman, and committee members.
And please state your name for the record, too.
Reverend Paul Slack, pastor of New Creation Church, and leader in Isaiah. So I'm glad to be with you today. And as you, I think, know, that Isaiah was at the fore of co-creating the collaborative group in the first place, because we believe that all voices working together can truly create a difference and a systemic change that is very well needed. Also, during this last year, we did an analysis of the stimulus money that came into the state via the Transportation Department. And what that stat showed was just 6.1% of DBE contractors won and were working on those contracts funded by that money. We've also talked in the collaborative about the need for a plan that contractors, prime contractors, would have on the forefront, so that there is some thought going into how to exactly include no more DBEs. We've also talked about the need to build for the capacity from DBEs so that they can grow their capacity and we can continue to diversify those who are on the contracts and hiring other people, as well as those who are in the workforce. We believe that this is good legislation, and we thank Representative Champion for putting it forward today. I also believe that it is consistent with what we are trying to do at the collaborative as a group of people. I know that it is consistent with what Isaiah stands for. in terms of building more inclusion in our system. You well know that our state is becoming more and more diverse with every day, and we need to ensure that those diversities are represented in every sector of our society. Thank you very much for this opportunity today. We stand in support.
Thank you, Reverend Slack and Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reverend Slack, is this a recommendation of the collaborative group?
Specifically, as I see it now, I've looked at the legislation. I believe it is consistent with a lot of our discussions. We have not voted, per se, on each one of these measures. As I look at what's in here, I believe we have discussed most, if not everything, that has come here that is represented in this legislation.
Representative Holbert?
But if I might, just for clarification, this is not the collaborative group's effort.
This is not the collaborative group's effort, nor it is not.
Okay, and am I to then, maybe help me out here. Usually when you're in a collaborative group, you work towards resolution as a group. So I'm assuming that this is some subsection of the collaborative group that's here today with this bill. I mean, how many people are on the group? And I mean, I'm just not quite understanding. It sounds like maybe the collaborative isn't done yet, but we have a bill here.
Reverend Slack, Mr. collaborative.
Yeah, thank you. To the collaborative point, I am a member of the collaborative. I've been a part of the collaborative discussions. The collaborative did not put forth this language to be presented here today. We found out about this language and what Representative Champion is trying to do here. And one of the things that we stand for and I stand for is sustainability. And I believe that if this passes into law, we create more sustainability and then will not have to continue to work in a collaborative effort to ensure that there's an adequate number of DBEs represented in work in projects in this state, nor would we continue to have to work towards an adequate number of workforce being diversified across race and gender. If it is in law in terms of how we both proceed in the industry about including DBEs as well as workers on sites.
Okay, and
Representative Holbert,
I'm sorry, but I just want to be really clear about this and what I'm hearing. So am I clear in that if this bill would pass, then you would view the work of the collaborative to be done?
No,
Reverend Slack.
No, the work would not be done. This represents one aspect.
Okay.
And not even an exhaustive aspect of that one aspect, a portion of the DBE side of what the collaborative currently discussing. There are two major sides of what the collaborative is discussing. One is DBE, and the other is workforce development or diversity. This is an aspect of the DBE side, but not in any sense is it exhaustive.
Thank
of the entire work of the class.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. And are there any other questions of Reverend Slack? Reverend Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Everyone's a minister here. Reverend Slack, Representative Leaders has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reverend Slack, I am not fully understanding the collaborative. Is that due to file a report? Or will that report, or when is your work done as a collaborative? And really, what groups are the collaborative, really?
Mr. Chair, the stakeholders who are at the collaborative table is growing. And right now, at the last meeting, there were probably 100 people who were at that meeting when it first began. I don't remember the exact number, but probably somewhere around 60. There's some other people who are here who could probably speak a little bit more specifically than that. But it has grown. It has grown both in numbers and in terms of the groups who've been represented at those tables. So if I missed something, I'm sure somebody will correct me. But there's prime contractors, there's DBE contractors, there are training organizations, the unions are represented at the table, apprentice organizations are represented at the table, the community is represented at the table. So those groups are there represented, but several people from across the state are participating in the collaborative discussions. The other part of your question that I need to address.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slack.
Chairman Leader.
When are you due to file a report?
Okay. Right now, we're on pace, according to the project manager from MnDOT, we're on pace to complete this phase of the work by December of this year.
Okay. Thank you. Let me just also interject. I mean, I've since we've started this process, as Mr. King said about a year ago, I have kept in touch with members of the collaborative and MnDOT. And I would just say over the last couple of months, I've gotten consistently positive feedback from both parties who are part of this process, both from MnDOT and members of the collaborative. So I'm encouraged about that, and I appreciate your efforts in that regard. Are there any further questions from the members of the committee? Well, thank you, Reverend Slack. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Mr. Blanks here? Okay. There's one other member, I think, who may be a proponent of the bill. I saw a wave of their hand. Okay. Would you like to move forward? Is there anyone else? Okay. Okay. Three more, and then we have Mr. Werke, and I would like to... okay. As many of you as you want to testify, fine, but we want to keep it... as succinct as possible, given the hour. So,
Mr. Chair,
welcome,
and Council. I appreciate you opening up this for discussion. My name is Benjamin Morrow, and I represent Steel Erection Technology. I've been in business for about 32 years. Excuse me. To give you a little history, short history, of what has happened with MnDOT. I was in the MnDOT program when it first started back in 1977 and 78. We went through this good faith effort before, and then from there we graduated to where they had a program where you had definite goals and incentives for the contractors, majority contractors, to fulfill. That was struck down from the AGC. Was behind it, okay? The country didn't have a program for about 3 years because of the lawsuits. I applaud Mr. Champion for bringing this bill forward because it does give us a little more bite, or it gives us a little more clarity, or it gives us a little more incentive for the majority contractor to adhere to what this bill is about or what the state is trying to do with their minority program. I've been through all facets of this whole thing, but I am in support of this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Morrill. Are there any questions of Mr. Morrill? Appreciate your coming out tonight. Hey, I saw a few more people.
Well, I don't mind if Jim Werke goes before me. If he's last for a specific reason.
Well, we generally have the proponents go first.
Okay,
and
and
I'm not even sure
Mr.
of
Chair?
Mr. Werke's position, so we'll let him explain that.
Mr. Chair, representatives, this committee, my name is Carlo Latchman Singh. I'm president of the National Association of Minority Contractors. First of all, I'm just going to give a little, history about myself as it relates to the disadvantaged program. I came to this country in 1971, went to school at St. Cloud State University, and after getting good education in the business program, decided to stay in this country. And I chose to be an American citizen. 20 years ago, I started my own business, and I enrolled in the various federally assisted programs here, one of which is the DBE, Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. And that program has made a significant difference in my life, my family, my community, and for the several organization members that belong to the National Association of Minority Contractors. First, I'd like to congratulate Representative Champion for bringing this legislation in front of your body here, because I think it is going to make a significant difference in terms of the areas that he has addressed. Too many times we've had legislation and other advocates come in front of subcommittees saying we need minority support and small business support, and the legislation gets passed, and after we look around to see what's going on here, our participation in those dollars are just marginal. Mr. Chair, all I can say is that this is very good legislation, and on behalf of the 60 members that I represent, we applaud Mr. Champion and all of you who would want to support this bill here to move to the next level.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lasmussen. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other advocates? Yes. Okay. Two more, and then we'll bring on any other opponents.
Good evening, committee, and Mr. Chair. My name is Douglas Starks, community stakeholder. I came into the collaborative probably about between a month and a half ago versus the 18 months everybody else was working on it. The fear and concern I have for my community is it was kind of a ruffled edge when I came in, because me and some other people from my community, we were arguing about accountability and sanctions because the people who heard testify before us spoke. They've been around since 72, and there was these efforts were supposed to be in place back then and were never followed or never sanctioned or never enforced. So it seems the collaborative is supposed to be coming to the same goal. However, whenever we talk about enforcement or sanctions or accountability, resistance goes crazy in the room. So you have people who say they want the same goal. It would be like to have a freedom collaborative with an attorney for a tyrant there. Like, you really don't want freedom. And somebody there really doesn't want to meet the goals. MnDOT has been here testifying for a few other bills here today. They're not here for this one. Or they're not going to testify for this one, I don't think, and there's a reason for it. I feel like I missed the opportunity by not speaking to the amendment, because I think every measure of accountability should be in the bill. That's my position. That's my community's position. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Starks? Okay. Thank you for coming. Is there any other proponent of the bill that would like to speak? Okay. Two. I will take two more, and then we'll move on. Okay? Two more individuals would like to come up. This would be the time to do so.
Good evening, committee. Good evening, Representative Champion. My name is Kathleen Meyer. I'm owner of Meyer Contracting. I'm a DBE company. I have been in the highway heavy construction business, primarily working in the Minnesota area since 1984. I'd like to stress the importance of this DBE program. It should give opportunities to small disadvantaged businesses who are not two and three generation owned majority companies. We have a struggle out there in terms of being competitive with our majority companies, because we haven't been around two and three generations. In terms of working with the Minnesota DOT Civil Rights Department, they have been, for the most part, dysfunctional. They have done their paperwork in terms of making sure that the federal dollars continue to come into the state, but they have not served our community well. And by that, I guess the only thing I can go back to is my personal experience with them. Now,
We have had many, many major projects come to the state here, one of them being the light rail. Now, I can't say, I can say that in one aspect, the DBE program has served a small company like mine, but it hasn't just been the program. It's been, like Congressman Sable, for example, was the majority congressman. When the light rail project came on board, he went to the joint venture, which was then Minnesota Constructors, who built that project. It was a joint venture of Granite McCrossin and Granite Construction of California and C.S. McCrossin here out of Minnesota. And both him and Senator Wellstone went down to the office of the Minnesota Constructors and said, this will not be another Federal Reserve-like project. You are going to do business with small businesses here in the state of Minnesota. And I do believe that is why I got an opportunity to work on that project. We have in terms of our civil rights department, I've seen many, many good specialists come and go through that department. And my motto to them was, if you do your job, you're going to lose your job. So they haven't had the support of the people that do their job interviews. So, I'm happy for the collaborative. I haven't been involved in it because I've been so discouraged over the last 20 years that I've been in business and the things that I've seen the Civil Rights Department do. I'm happy for this legislation, and I thank Representative Champion for having come on board and presented it. And what we need to do is we need to have some enforcement so that the tax dollars that I pay, the tax dollars that my employees pay, that we get an opportunity to work on these projects that are public projects. That's what Title VI is about. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Are there questions of the testifier? Thank you very much for coming. And now we have one final proponent, I believe, and then we'll move on to some additional testimony.
This is very new for me.
Okay, well, welcome. So we state your name for the record.
Stephanie Marlowe.
Okay.
Chairman and reps, I have a question for you, okay? Why are we, after so many years, talking the same issues on a fair play with women and minority sub and general contractors? So I have a question. If anyone wants to answer that, why are we going through the same issue after all of these years? And we haven't. I hear that you've moved it this, or I guess right here. We were right here at one time. The sub and general contractors with MnDOT. And now we're right here. What, after 30 years? How long have you? And we're right here. So I'm asking you, what is it that we're not doing? And one more thing. This good faith effort needs to stay in place. It needs to stay in place so it can be fair across the board for everyone. There's plenty out there for everybody. That's it.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. And
will anyone answer that, please?
Representative Champion?
Just so you know that the committee hears testimony, they are not the ones to be questioned. And so we hear testimony, and this legislation is here, and us wonderful stakeholders would be happy to keep talking to you about progress and what steps we believe should be in place in order to empower and to make sure that all of our quality of life is improved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I have Mr. Werke. I don't know if there's anyone else who would like to testify. And thank you for your patience, Mr. Werke, and welcome back. You're here.
Chairman, committee members, good evening. Thank you. I'm going to try to be brief and sort through my comments here, but a couple of things I think need to be pointed out. First of all, with respect to general contractors and AGC, we have and continue to fully support the efforts of the collaborative. We believe that the solutions and the changes that are discussed in that environment are good and have been good and should continue because there are many unresolved issues. This is a very complex and involved topical area. One of my statements I've made multiple times is that the programs that we're discussing about need to work for both general contractors and for DBE subcontractors. If general contractors are not successful and cannot be successful in these programs, then I submit that DBEs will not be successful as well, because they are the subs that are submitting quotes to the generals and through the contractual relationship that bears out. That being said, AGC believes the best way to improve these programs and to improve participation is to get about the business of building a much bigger, stronger stable of competent, ready, willing, and able DBE subcontractors. And I'm going to illustrate that to you with a few numbers. There are about 450 certified DBEs that MnDOT maintains on their list. Approximately around 250 of those DBEs have NAICS codes that say that they can actually perform highway heavy work. Of that 250, only about 40 to 60 regularly quote subs or directly bid work at MnDOT. That's the pool that my general contractors work with. We need to build that 40 to 60 into 400 or 600 in order to build participation at these levels. This is a program that, as you all know, this is a low bid environment. Contractors are very competitive. They have to hone their bids in a cost competitive environment, and working with emerging businesses, and this is also a problem. We're working with these emerging businesses. For them to be cost competitive is a very difficult proposition. They need to be able to participate and have assistance and be able to participate, and we're working on those things within the collaborative. They are under active consideration. A couple of comments about the legislation, and I need to be frank about this. AGC does not support this legislation in its current construct. And in fact, I would submit to you, if this bill were to become law, I wouldn't foresee a need to go back to the collaborative. This bill presupposes many of the outcomes that the collaborative is currently undertaking in active consideration. It is a give and take process. We spend countless hours going through these issues. For folks to come and put this in legislation and then now compel some of these things into law that we are actively considering, I don't think is a fair process. I would, again, actively have to think about going back to a collaborative meeting if this were to become law because of the compulsory aspects of this. Additionally, many aspects of the bill already are prescribed in federal law. This is a federal aid assistance program. The federal government prescribes the rules that have to be played by here. And many of these, including the sanction element, including the eligibilities up and down the line, we are compelled by federal law to uphold what those federal requirements are. So I think in some sense the bill is unnecessary. Those things already exist. Lastly, I just want to reiterate that we continue to support the collaborative, and we're going to continue to work within that structure if it can be a productive and respectful environment. And so far, I think we have done some of that. I'm concerned about the amount of and the size of the group that gets together. It is a very time-consuming commitment. I understand the frustrations. I have frustrations as well. These things have taken far too long, and I have empathy for the comments made in front of me that we are still sitting here where we were 15, 20 years ago, and we need to work on those things for this to get better. But I will tell you, in my opinion, if we pursue some of these things that are part of this legislation, we may just be back here again next year looking at the same issues, just cut a little bit different. So I will leave my comments at that and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Questions of Mr. Werke? Yes, Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Werke, getting back to Stephanie Marlowe's questions, it's obviously people are not seeing any real progress here. So what needs to happen so we can get some progress? You mentioned something about figures. Is there not enough participants? Is that what you mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mason, that is the majority of my comment is yes. We need to get more people certified into the MnDOT program to perform highway heavy work. And, you know, currently right now, if you look at the majority of the disciplines of the work that the certified DBE firms are involved in, it is in a lot of it is in the closeout items on contracts. Things like landscaping, things like striping, things like guardrail. Those things are not high volume components of highway contracts. It's not ironwork. It's not concrete paving. Those types of things that provide the high volume dollar elements that would allow for additional dollar participation. And the last thing with respect to that, Senator Representative Mason, is that when these folks are certified and become part of the program, it's built into the base. It helps in the future to raise the level of the participation rate. So instead of a 6% goal, we can have a 9% or a 12% or an 18% goal because we have certified, qualified DBE vendors within the pool from which to select to be subcontractors.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions, Representative Holberg and Representative Leader? And then we'll give Representative Champion the last word, and then we will vote.
Mr. Chair, I am sorry, and I'll
be real
brief here. The collaborative process, I heard somebody talk, there was 60 to 100 people. Is there like a leadership team? Can you explain to me how we get something done when it's 60 to 100 people?
Mr. Werke or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I'm not sure how. I mean, and let me illustrate. I've been at probably 95% of the collaborative meetings. The faces around the table change at every meeting. So the frustration from my perspective and contractors, general contractors, is that we're not sure who is speaking for what entities. There's enough confusion in the room, whether we're talking about DBE or whether we're talking about workforce inclusion, to not be able to know who is speaking for what communities, who is actually raising an issue, and who can answer those issues on behalf of who they represent. Now, in credit, MnDOT has gotten a professional facilitator involved. I think that has helped the discussions immensely. It has taken the onus off blaming the department for what is going on, and it has, in essence, empowered the group to make decisions. But I would submit that I am not sure that there is a structure within that group that can lead us to some outcomes that are valuable.
Representative Leader.
Thank you. That's exactly the question I was going to ask, because I was wondering, again, I asked about membership before, but if you got an unwieldy membership and it changes, isn't there a normal complement, basically? If you're dealing with that large a group, I think we've got some problems.
Representative Leader, Mr. Chair, yes. And another element that needs to be brought into perspective here. There are two entities involved in every item that comes before the collaborative. Every item. The two entities are the administrative authority, which is MnDOT, and general contractors. The rest of the folks in the room have separate individual parochial issues that are, they are not affected. The folks that are there for workforce inclusion, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people tell me, I really don't care about DBE. I'm here to learn to advocate for workforce inclusion, or the other way around. But I have to be at every one of those meetings, as also to have representatives from my contracting firms, and it is a time commitment. But we're willing to make that time commitment if there is a productive end that we can see. I don't view this as a productive end. I view this as almost an end run to come over here and put into play elements of something that was in a discussion environment that now are going to be compulsory.
Okay, Representative Morrow, unless you have an additional question, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Working, Representative Champion. You know, from sitting here, it seems like this is one of those situations that's obviously gone on well too long, that movement needs to be made, that there has been some, I think, signs of spring. I think MnDOT's appointment of a, I don't know if it's a mediator or facilitator is the right word, but I think that's a helpful sign. I've only been here 3.5 years, but I've seen enough times where the frustration just bubbles over and something needs to be done to at least give a sense of breaking a logjam. And I'm not close enough to know whether this bill is that thing, but what I see in this bill is at least a place to continue building. And if nothing else, Representative Champion, I've seen you try to build consensus and get bills done in our time together here. And I feel fairly confident that you will be committed to making sure that we have a process and a bill here at the end that gets us closer to solving 30, 50, 100, or 200 or more years of concern. And Mr. Working, I know that you and I have worked on other bills in the past, and I would be sorry to see AGC walk away from the table. I understand that. I hear your frustration as well. So I hope that the discussions can continue. And I hope that people will continue to listen as well as talk with each other on this.
Thank you. And yes, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to testify, just a quick question. Give me a rough estimate of a time frame of when you think recommendations would come out of your group.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, I would like to give you a time frame that would be a lot sooner than later, and I think that is definitely something that needs to be adhered to. I can't tell you how it's going to end up. These are difficult discussion items, and I'm not sure there's going to be agreement on them. And if there isn't agreement on them, am I going to be sitting in this chair again next January? Probably. And I just don't believe in a process that says when you can't agree with people around the table, you still continue to negotiate with them in one room and then come over and appeal to a higher authority in the other room. And that's what I'm frustrated with here. And I guess the answer to your question is I don't know.
Hey, Representative Mason, and I feel like we are pretty informed on this. So
thank you.
You'll get the last question.
Mr. Chair, again, Mr. Ward. What is it that you're seeing as the main obstacles to preventing a consensus?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, I don't know if there's one item. There are many items, but there are also successes. We haven't had the time to talk about those successes. The OJT program, you heard Mr. King talk about some of the things on the employment side that have been successes. There are a number of things that are still there. I think fundamentally, in order for this program to succeed and to achieve goals that are beyond what we currently have been able to achieve, we need to do better at building certified DBEs into that pool. And I know there are differences, the folks behind me, there are differences of opinion on that. But I think, you know, the bill, the main concern, one of the main concerns to our members is in this bill, which is right in the first line of the bill, which talks about making the DBE at the time of letting a compulsory element to bidding on the project. I don't represent every contractor in the state. In fact, AGC only represents about 60% of the contractors. The other 40% haven't been at the table. I don't know where they are, but they're not there. They're not the folks that I represent, but there are. They bid on this work as well. And we're talking about on the DBE at the time of letting, that is a large change in the bidding environment in terms of what it means, in terms of putting bids together, in terms of demands on the department, in terms of clearing those contracts, in terms of clearing the good faith effort components for every one of those projects that are bid every week. And I'm not so sure if the department was sitting up here and you talk to their contract people, that their contract people would say they'd have faith that they can actually do that.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, we'll let Representative Champion have the last word. Thank you, Mr. Werke.
First of all, Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for engaging us. I know that this is a very tough topic, and I appreciate your patience, and I hope that you'll be praying for me that I'm married still tomorrow by the time I get home. Let me say this. I think that the issue so eloquently articulated by Mr. Werke are really the whole reason why we have this legislation before us. One is to think about building capacity. How can you build capacity if you don't have a real intentional plan as to how you build that capacity? How do you build capacity if you don't have a real intentional plan around training? How do you build capacity if you do not have a clear understanding as to where the strengths and weaknesses are? Because we do agree that we want to build capacity. We want to make sure that DBE firms are able to compete and to be in the marketplace and to provide a service for all of us, because that improves their quality of life as it improves the lives of their families. It is also clear that when we think in terms of federal law, there's some things that the federal law just doesn't quite answer. It gives us guiding principles around. But here's what is also interesting. What we're asking for, what I'm putting forth or suggesting or proposing in this legislation is what Met Council does right now. This is not new. This is not as if another state agency is not doing the very thing. And my conversations with them was, it's very successful. Do people like to do it always? No. But is it intentional around making sure that they're thinking about inclusion and who they're talking to and really thinking in terms of good faith efforts? That provides clarity even for the prime, because they know who they're talking to, what sort of bid are they going to get. Does it work when we think in terms of this scheme of things? So when they put that forward, or that information, or that bid forward, have they done all their due diligence? Is the DBE capable of doing exactly what it is that they say that they're going to do and can do? And so I think that this is appropriate legislation. I do agree that Representative Morrow is right. I do believe in constantly collaborating with others. I've made a commitment even to MnDOT, their collaborative group, to go over and chat with them about the one point in this, well, at least I think it's one point in this legislation that they have some questions about, is around the separation of the goal. And is there another way by which to get the information that we're looking for a different way? Or even being open to them, you know, thinking about that and how to make sense. We're all clear that what's articulated here is what the collaborative has talked about. And it wasn't an end run, because this information was gained by way of another town hall meeting and other key stakeholders talking. Not from a group of people who say that they're angry with something that's going on during the collaborative. But there is some frustration around what do we need to have in place in order to give us the assurance and the confidence that we're working towards this end, which is inclusion, foster inclusion. So I renew my motion.
Yep. It's your motion is to have us approve and House File 3099 as amended and re-refer it to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. 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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, members. Now, just two quick announcements before we adjourn. Tomorrow we have a doubleheader. Representative Holberg and I have a number of bills, so please show up on time. We are going to meet at 1 o'clock in room 5. We have 6 bills to go through. If we don't get through all of those, then we will take those when we reconvene at 6 o'clock. Now, that's tomorrow night, 6 o'clock and 300 North. So 1 o'clock in room 5, and we have 10 bills in the evening in 300 North. And members, with that, and unless we get referrals from the Senate, we're done with our work tomorrow night, so for the session. And members, just let's also thank our committee administrator, Abby Brydick, because we have had a flurry of last-minute bill requests, not only from members, but agencies. And we are, this chair is accommodating just about everybody, and that's the way the process should work. Open, transparent. We've had some changes. We've put this on the web. We've taken some bills off. We've added them as they've come on. And that's the spirit with which this committee works. So, Representative Holbrook, I don't know if you had any thoughts or comments.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. So, members, with that, we stand adjourned until 1 o'clock tomorrow.